OTB AM.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.
Good morning, you're very welcome along to OTB AM, and the studio this morning feels a little bit like Christmas Eve. There's a lot of excitement. We've got the cookies laid out, we've got the milk laid out, although there is no Santa, John Duggan. It's just
I'm Santa,
Cup.
Owen.
You are Santa, we've got
Good morning.
Santa.
You see this Ryder Cup Hay Club 2006.
It's beautiful.
Just a part of lots of memorabilia that I brought in this morning for the Off the Ball AM Ryder Cup special.
Can we call 2006 nostalgia? Is it too recent to call it nostalgia? I'm certainly going to call it nostalgia.
It is nostalgia because it was probably the peak of the Celtic Tiger. It was a very novel thing to happen to our country. I know we'd had World Golf Championships at Mount Juliet in 02 and 04, but this was amazing. It was the United States coming to Ireland and Europe playing the USA, the Ryder Cup, and winning by 18.5 points to 9.5. And it's such a brilliant event every couple of years, and it's back on the European side now, of course, in Paris.
Yeah, absolutely. There is going to be more nostalgia coming up a little bit later on, so we don't want to use all the good stuff just yet. So just in terms of this year's Ryder Cup, as I say, I'm not being facetious when I say it feels like Christmas Eve. It's one of my favourite sporting events, mainly because it turns polite golfers into absolute animals, potentially, for over the course of 3 days. Certainly on the Sunday, it tends to happen, like Rory versus Patrick Reed 2 years ago, is something that I hope happens again, but I hope it's like 10 times more violent.
Well, it probably won't be more violent. I think golf has that limit, and that is probably the limit of the gentlemanly aspect of
such
the game.
Shame.
But I think that golf is such a gentlemanly game, and it's revered for that. This is why it's so exciting, because I think the whole format is geared towards hooping and a hollering and, you know, a team event. And the Americans, I was reading overnight that in the 80s, this wasn't even on the radar of American sports media. And it wasn't only until Europe won for the first time in 1987 at Muirfield in Ohio, Jack Nicklaus was Captain America, that what's happened here? Because the Americans don't like to lose. 89, it was a draw. And then 91, we had that war on the shore here at Kiwa Island. And Europe have won 10 times and have lost 8 times since 1979. And I think it's 10-5 and a draw since the breakthrough in 85. So the Americans don't like to lose. And that's what's brought the Ryder Cup to a new level, I think, because it's different in terms of the way the players and the fans react, as they would maybe because the major is very much an individual thing. It's been very even. And I think of the 19 tournaments that the USA and Europe have been involved in since 1979, 7 of them have been down to the wire, where it's been 14.5 to 13.5. And there's a lot of people predicting it'll be the same this week in Paris.
Yeah, I think the Americans would really hate losing this week because they feel so confident.
This is the best ranked American team in history. So that's the reason. I think it's just over 11 in the world that their 12 players are ranked as an average. Mm. And they've got, I think, 11 of their 12 players are in the top 17 in the world. It just roses at the top of the pile. I think Dustin Johnson and he have been going close in the world rankings, but Francesco Molinari is the Open champion, but European players have not won a tournament since the Open, and the Americans come into it in better form. But this goes out the window.
It does.
Europe many times have been poorly ranked, but you've got great stories, and I think that why we're so feeling like it's Christmas Eve, Owen, is, and we do throughout the year with other sports, with Cheltenham, with hurling, with the Six Nations. These things don't come around every week, and it's good that they don't, and that it comes around every couple of years, and it's either in the States or it's over here. It's been 4 years since Glen Eagles and Paul McGinley, and I think why we're tuned into it from a national pride point of view is that the Irish lineage of the Ryder Cup has been so strong.
Yeah.
In 1973, we joined the European Union, and that's the first year we played in the Ryder Cup. In 87, Eamon D'Arcy won a crucial match against Ben Crenshaw when we won in Ohio. In 89, who can forget the late Christy O'Connor Jr.'s 2-iron when he beat Fred Couples. We had Philip Walton's winning hole against Jay Haas in 95. We had Paul McGinley's winning putt in 2002. We had Padraig Harrington going out in the first morning with Monty in 04 and beating Woods and Mickelson to the extent where we had the Ryder Cup here, and McGinley and Harrington were in the team. And Darren Clark, that emotional moment at the K Club when he hit that ball off the first tee. So we've had that Irish GMAC winning the winning point in Celtic Manor in 2010, I think it was. So we've had that Irish link throughout, and Padraig is a vice captain this week, and of course Rory's playing.
Having been at a lot of the biggest sporting events in the world, like obviously you're at the World Cup for us this summer, where does the Ryder Cup rank in terms of great sporting events?
It's up there. I prefer individual golf, but I think the Ryder Cup, what I'd say to people is it's very much a television event.
Okay.
I went to the Belfry and I worked in 2002 and I didn't leave the media centre, because you can't be walking around, you don't know what's going on. unless you've got a radio, and that's more difficult because you need to see what's going on, because there's so many moving parts, and there might be a group or four-ball or foursome that is behind, and they've already finished.
Yeah.
So you need to find out, and it's just made for television.
Every group counts.
And I only saw one shot live in 2002 at the 10th at the Belfry. I didn't get to see much of the K Club. So if you're a spectator, you have to be very strategic and carefully work out what you're going to be doing. But I think a lot of Irish and English have gone out there because that you do get that stadium feel, though. You don't get it at an Open or an Irish Open or a British Open, or maybe the Masters might have that reverence, but I don't know if you have that stadium feel that you have at the Ryder Cup. And I think the Golf National has been very well laid out in that regard this week.
Yeah, plenty more on the Ryder Cup coming out throughout this morning on OTB AM. Let's tell you what else is coming up in just a few minutes. We'll bring you the sports pages. Then we're going to play you an interview with Jack McCaffrey. I sat down with him down at the PwC headquarters yesterday. He was, of course, the PwC GAA GPA player of the match for the All-Ireland final this year. So he was collecting his award, and we chat about a few things about his season coming back from injury and all that. We'll also chat to the O'Donovan brothers. They popped into studio here to us yesterday as well. We'll chat about their World Championship win, a little bit about funding and dealing with fame as well. That's coming up later on. And Ariel Helwani will be back with us on OTB AM. He hasn't been on the show in quite some time. He's obviously, his profile has taken off. He works for ESPN now. He's going to chat to us a little bit about his new digs over in ESPN. But of course, the main reason why we're chatting to him is the build-up to the big fight in Vegas between Khabib and McGregor on Saturday week. And of course, the main man himself, Nathan Murphy, will be live with us from Le Golf National, as himself and John bask in the nostalgic memories of the Ryder Cup. Before all that, though, as I say, it's time for the back pages.
OTB AM.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.
We'll start with the Irish Times this morning, and it's Ryder Cup all the way. Ramon Garcia could form new Spanish Armada, says Philip Reid this morning. Rookie and veteran campaigner may team up at some stage of the competition. There's also a good Le Golf National diary with a couple of tidbits from the week so far. And grandstand start to offer test of nerves. So amphitheatres have got bigger over the years, and this week scales new heights. It looks incredible, the course over there. Like, we'll get to Nathan very shortly to actually get the close-up view of it all, but even just looking at the sort of grandstands, as it says in the headline there, looking at the setting, it's quite a narrow course, a lot of the fairways you're going to
water.
Have. And oh, a lot of water.
Water, and that's going to make a splash in terms of excitement.
Yeah, like, it's, I don't know, it's the Phoenix Open, is it? The
real Arizona.
Party, Arizona, yeah. The real party atmosphere over in the US.
16th hole.
It kind of reminds me of that course a tiny bit, Le Golf National. Just looking at the setup, it looks, I don't want to say artificial as such, but it does kind of have the bang of a course in a city off it, which isn't a bad thing. It does kind of lead to these great atmospheres that we get over in the States sometimes in the PGA Tour. And, you know, we talk about sort of the geeing the crowd up and getting a bit of excitement going. Seems like the perfect sort of venue for this sort of stuff.
Yeah, and that's what the Americans will be hoping to do. They'll be hoping to quieten the crowd by winning matches and getting ahead on the scoreboard. And often the Ryder Cup is formed by the ebb and the flow. I think we saw that at Medina a few years ago, that Europe kept on hanging in there on the Saturday when they were struggling. And they got to, I think it was 10-6 behind, and then they won, of course, in the final day, that miracle. Maybe Seve inspired. So it's all about sometimes silencing the crowd, and Seve was great at that in the United States. Have the winning putt in 87. But yeah, I'm hoping that the crowds will be in tandem with what you're talking about, with the amphitheatre element of it, and can get behind the Europeans, because I think the Europeans will need that. They'll need everything on their side. They'll need the fans on their side. They'll need the chemistry of the pairings. They'll need that spirit that we sometimes feel that they wanted a little bit more than the Americans. And that's why they've been able to punch above and have won more Ryder Cups than the Americans since the beginning of the battle.
Are you all for the spreading out of the venues in terms of the Ryder Cup, like getting it out of the traditional venues a bit more, like Rome, obviously? I was just reading, who was it at the weekend? Someone, maybe in the Sunday Independent or maybe Saturday's Indo, talking about the idea that Rome getting ready for the Ryder Cup is almost like an Olympic scale project, like in terms of infrastructure, in terms of the excitement around
it. It's great, but also they've got the Open champions from Italy. And this is Europe. This is not a Great Britain and Ireland tournament anymore. It's a European tournament. It should be in Sweden. It should be in Germany. It should be in Italy. I mean, we had it here, and hopefully we'll have it here again in 2026 with the Derry Manor. I hope that happens, because Derry Manor is fitting to host any Ryder Cup tomorrow.
Yeah,
with the work they've done on the course there. But yeah, I think it should go around Europe, and it's all about expanding the game. And I think that I was looking at the world rankings last night, and even I think in 2002, the European average was way worse than it is now, and the Americans as well. So I think the game has become a little bit more transatlantic as opposed to global. You know, like the South Africans are not as dominant as they were in the game, and the Australians are not as dominant. So, you know, we want to see the Ryder Cup going around Europe. And like the course is sometimes, look, it's the European Tour is big money spinner. When the Ryder Cup happens, it funds the European Tour until the next Ryder Cup happens.
Yeah.
So they might not necessarily make a profit during the non-years, but they make a profit on the years. That's why it's in these kind of resort courses, as it were, I've described them. You're not going to be playing it at St. Andrews. I'd love to see it at St. Andrews at the Lynx course, but that's the way it is. And to be fair to them, they've laid out the course as well to suit themselves.
Yeah, it has been a bad week for the European Tour, though, really, with the comments from Rory McIlroy saying that he's going to give up a few of his events and probably not playing the European Tour till the Irish Open next year, which is a real blow to them. So obviously a big money spinner for them this weekend. Irish Examiner also going with the Ryder Cup this morning. Turning the Air Blue, reads the headline, with a picture quite pointedly, I would say, of Patrick Reed, because they asked the question, which Ryder Cupper will get hot under the collar in Paris? Is it going to be Mr. Reed?
John Rahm, potentially.
Yeah.
Could get a hot under the collar. Tyrrell Hatton. Is another
is he known for that?
Oh, Tyrrell Hatton, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Tyrrell Hatton, to the ridicule of some Americans when he was playing over there recently. But sometimes that can be like John Rahm sees that as a positive, to be able to channel his emotions, his passion, and his anger at times into good things on a golf course. It's when it becomes a negative. And for Patrick Reed, you cannot say it was anything but a positive.
Positive.
And once again, shushing the crowd and the pantomime villain. Sometimes it's good to be a pantomime villain.
Yeah.
So there's enough apple pie around in golf for us to enjoy the pantomime villain. And I don't think Rory actually lived up to getting involved in that.
No.
At Hazeltine, I don't think he didn't look the part.
Yeah.
Patrick Reed looked the part. Whereas sometimes, like if you're just like Woods, you don't need to do this.
No.
You're Tiger Woods, you're almost like at a bigger level and let the other guys do this. But we've seen some, like Justin Leonard, to me, seemed the most placid Texan when he was burst on the scene in the late 90s. But when he held that putt in 17 at Brookline, it went bananas. And then the whole American team.
The invasion onto the green.
The worst costumes that were ever seen. And this is one of the quirks of the Ryder Cups, these uniforms that they wear, these weird costumes and weird shirts, and generally European fashion has been better than the American fashion.
Well, you could say that. I wouldn't claim to be a fashion expert whatsoever, but I do like the way that the Americans look this year. Not those polo shirts, because they look crap, but the kind of tracky top that Tiger Woods was wearing yesterday in his press conference. I like that. So I think they've got it right on at least one garment this year anyway, the Americans. We're going to change tack to football a small bit, because on the back page of the Irish Independent it says Pogba holding out for Barca move. Training ground spat with Mourinho adds to speculation over Fran star's future at United. Before we get into that, just a little bit, just to tell you what else is on the back of the Irish Indo. So IRFU prepare record deal to fend off Murray's suitors. So that's big news there for Munster fans, for Ireland fans, indeed, that there's going to be a big offer there for Conor Murray to make sure he stays on these shores. And of course, Ram set for McIlroy partnership, says Brian Keogh in Paris. But let's just go back to the Paul Pogba story, because it seems that every morning now we've got a new story in the relationship between Paul Pogba and Jose Mourinho. Just 24 hours ago, we were speaking about Paul Pogba being told he will never captain Manchester United again while Jose Mourinho is in charge. And then shortly after that, yesterday morning at around 11 o'clock or midday, this footage emerged. So as you can see here, it's Jose Mourinho saying something to Paul Pogba, which kind of catches him off guard a little bit. He's a little bit rattled there, as you can see. He says something back to Jose, and Jose saying something back to him. We understand that what was said was that Jose Mourinho was unhappy with an Instagram story that was posted on Paul Pogba's account from the previous night. He was laughing. He was enjoying himself. He was in jubilant form, I think it's fair to say, after Manchester United had lost to Derby County in a penalty shootout. Jose, not happy with that. And that's via Sky Sports, by the way, with that footage. Jose, not happy with that Instagram post. I can't imagine Jose's actually on Instagram scrolling through his players' stories. So he's obviously been informed of this by somebody else. And Paul Pogba, I would say, claims that he wasn't laughing at his teammates, but rather just enjoying the night.
Well, it's just another, I'll just go through the, because this is linked, Owen, to the Red Tops. All of dominated by Paul Pogba and Jose Mourinho. Jose snubs Pogba agent. This is the Herald. Herald Sport back page. Jose Mourinho has ordered Manchester United chiefs to cut all ties with influential agent Mino Raiola, this is the Italian-Dutch agent, as he steps up his power battle with Paul Pogba. This is the agent that Alex Ferguson had no time for when Pogba left back in 2012 to go to Juventus. Didn't work out at United. Raiola posted a message on social media last month urging United to sell his client to Barcelona, with Mourinho convinced the players' snipes in the media at his tactics are being directed by his cash-hungry advisor. €220 million. United demanding world record fee for Pogba. Now, this is about whether he's going to Barcelona, who do not have the funds to buy him in January, so maybe next summer. But from other reports I'm reading this morning, Mourinho wants him gone in January.
Who do you think he's going to go to? If he's sold in January, who do you think is best place to go?
I think he's going to go to Barcelona.
But do Barca want him?
I think they do, yeah. I think Barcelona could do with a player like Pogba in their team. Before we come to the other headlines in the back pages of the Red Tops, we'll just keep on this Pogba story. Mirror Sports, Mourinho and Pogba clash again. And now the manager demands United's £89 million signing is ditched in the New Year transfer window. Get rid of him. That's in the Mirror. The Sun, him or me? Jose calls for backing over a Pogba feud. Jose Mourinho expects the Manchester United board to back him completely over his amazing public bust of Paul Pogba. The United boss can be heard saying, get out, during a row with Pogba. And there's an article as well, I think, by Neil Custis. United must back Jose, just the way the board did for Ferguson over Beckham, Keane, Van Nistelrooy and Stam. Alex Ferguson got rid of David Beckham, Roy Keane, Ruud Van Nistelrooy and Stam. And nobody at the club questioned him. That's the back of the Sun. Also in the Irish Daily Mail, nothing about Pogba. Walters, woe. John Walters, injured veteran battling to save his career, 6 months out due to an Achilles tendon. So that's really the Pogba stuff. But I think it's over for Pogba at United. And I think I remember during the World Cup, okay, he's ensconced in his camp with the French team. Deschamps is a good disciplinarian manager who's dealt with the likes of Samir Nasri, who were not part of the team in previous years to that. And he left some players out of the World Cup squad. And Pogba stepped up. Wasn't the captain, Hugo Lloris was the captain, but he stepped up as a leader at the World Cup. But I even found, having been hovering around the media area after the final when it beat Croatia, Pogba was very excitable, the loudest person there, joking, laughing, and I can see why he's popular with the players, but I don't think he can help himself in terms of opening his mouth. Mm. And the person who's advising him doesn't seem to be very popular with football managers, you know, Raiola, his agent, and I just think the guy might be a little bit immature. And it's disappointing to see somebody who was lauded by Mourinho for stepping up at the World Cup, showing leadership, not really through anything, but he gave a very good speech after the semi-final against Belgium, reminding players that the final was not won yet. But through his performances, he was excellent in the final. To me, he was definitely on the team of the tournament. Given the captaincy, I think for the opening game against Leicester, because Valencia was injured, put in a good display, but just can't keep his mouth shut. And you don't undermine the manager, saying things like attack, attack, attack after the Wolves game, which was, we all know, was the Ferguson way, mm-hmm. that United fans want to see United going back to that style of football. That is just a red rag to a bull. And I think Mourinho cannot be undermined. Whatever people think about Mourinho's style, his attitude, where he's bringing United vis-a-vis Manchester City and Liverpool, I think Pogba's been badly advised. And I think if Pogba is gone, this is his last chance in world football. I think he's 25 years of age now. Yeah. This is his last chance, possibly at a really big club, to prove himself, not as a isolated guy who's got a bigger sense of himself than the team. Because I don't think you hear this about Ronaldo. You just see Ronaldo making himself the best version that he can be to go against Lionel Messi as the best player in the world. Luka Modric was a Tottenham player, and I'm a Tottenham fan, but he was an extremely good player at a club that was just below the top tier of English football, is now one of the best player in the world if you listen to FIFA, and Real Madrid has been one of the most influential players at Real Madrid in recent times. Should Paul Pogba not be concentrating more on what he's doing himself rather than getting involved in these soap operas of managers? Because there's only going to be one winner, and even if Mourinho does not last there that long, he's not going to lose this battle, I don't think.
In a way, it's last chance saloon for both of the parties involved.
Yeah, so. Mourinho doesn't have another... Is there another big club for Jose Mourinho to go to?
I don't think so.
It's probably international management where Jose Mourinho is going next. Real did not work out. Chelsea the second time, despite winning the title in the second season, did not work out the second time. And Pogba, if you believe the reports, is popular with the players. But you can't do what he's doing. You can't undermine the manager.
No. Like, it's the undermining of the manager which is kind of making my opinion change a little bit on Paul Pogba, because I previously would have been a big supporter of Paul Pogba, particularly in this battle. I'd kind of tend to side with the players in most occasions, but like the whole thing about Instagram and all that sort of stuff, it's like, it's a 20-something-year-old, you know, he does what he does, it's just the way he is. He's
timing.
Timing, that is key. It may be, as you say, ill-advised. It's not actually any malice from Paul Pogba, whereas I think the attack comment kind of felt like close to deliberate undermining of the manager. And it was at that point that I thought, right, okay, just...
What has Paul Pogba to gain by coming out and making these comments? What does he have to gain by it? And Ferguson is the oracle. He is the god of Manchester United. And if Ferguson says this agent is bad, he's a bad egg. Mm. Does that not tell you everything you need to know? And he's the only player attached to that agent now in the club. And I think the problem though for United right now is that now, and they're going to make a profit on Pogba, which so there's no issue with the revenue here. I think the 590 million was sterling revenues that they posted the other day. They're going to, so whatever this expensive player in the world or expensive player in the Premier League, they're going to make a profit on Pogba.
Yeah.
So because Pogba's stock is high, they can let him go. But like when Ferguson was having these decisions to make about certain players, like Jaap Stam, who I think he regretted selling. He had other players. He had enough players in the team. If Pogba goes from United, is he as replaceable? And with Alexis Sanchez, for example, not firing, that's the problem United have. They don't have five or six players that are really performing at the moment.
Sure. The thing that I worry about here, and I think when you say he's badly advised, I think there is a huge argument in favour of that, because we've seen these stories come out over the last fortnight, which have been bubbling under the surface for a few months, that agents are going to be clamped down upon very, very soon, that there will be an international directive to ensure that agents' fees are going to get destroyed, because it is a plight in the game. And Mino Raiola is looking at that.
It's a scourge in the game.
And Raiola is thinking to himself, oh shit, I'm going to lose a lot of money very shortly unless I get one big payday out of perhaps my biggest client. So it's in his interest to get Paul Pogba a very big move in January before potentially next summer his ability to make a lot of money for himself is destroyed. It's a bit of a conspiracy theory, but I would say Raiola's looking at those headlines and is like, okay, I've got to make sure I can get my parts moving again. And he's saying to Paul Pogba, you know what, maybe you should move. Maybe you should move for a new world record fee. And if I happen to make a lot of money off that, well, so be it. We'll all be happy. So perhaps that's part of it. And I think the bad advice he's getting has been accelerated by the stories we're seeing around agents at the moment. The other paper to lead with it, of course, is the Times Ireland edition. Mourinho stuck with Pogba, they say. United determined to keep player and manager at the club. Pair at new low after training ground row over Instagram posts. Just to touch on the UK back pages for a moment, because they're leading with a bit on Pogba, but also Eden Hazard. Hazard hits wonder goal as Chelsea win 2-1 at Liverpool in the Carabao Cup, and it's also on the back page of The Guardian. Brilliant Hazard leaves Anfield's feeling blue. Let's hear from Kevin Kilbane. He was speaking about Eden Hazard and that goal last night in the show.
Kevin Kilbane, it's into 5 minutes of added time at Anfield. Chelsea 2, Liverpool 1. Tell us about that wonderful Eden Hazard goal.
Well, all I'm saying is goal of the season. I can't see this being bettered across the course of the season. So Eden Hazard, he's come on here tonight and he's on it. You know when a player's on it. Literally, he's everywhere looking to try to get on the ball. So what he does, he picks up the ball in the centre of the pitch, really. Beats a couple of Liverpool players to start with, and then he gets a lovely little nutmegs. Plays it out wide, goes back and gets the return pass. Then he's still got loads and loads of work to do. He's right out on the right wing. He steps inside Naby Keita, then he nutmegs Alberto Moreno, so he's on an angle, and then he absolutely smashes it past Simon Mignolet in goal. It's just an absolutely incredible goal.
Yeah, it was absolutely sensational. He is the best player playing in Britain at the moment.
I love Eden Hazard. That's why I love football. That's what I grew up loving, Maradona. It doesn't happen as much as it used to. Individual brilliance in players, and I've seen Hazard. I saw Hazard play in the flesh 4 years ago, and he scored a brilliant individual goal against Arsenal. Love watching him at the World Cup. Just he's the reason I watch football. De Bruyne, the reason I watch football. Mbappe, the reason I watch football. I can admire great defending, but these are the moments. The Salah last season, where the moment of magic. That's what it brings you back to when you're a boy and going, I want to be this guy. And
did Belgium underachieve by not getting to the World Cup final?
No, they didn't underachieve. They didn't have enough top players 1 to 11 in the team. And France were the better team in the semi-final. So they did not underachieve. They caught Brazil on the hop in the quarter-final. But also, the best goal of the season. Did anybody see John McGinn's goal for Aston Villa?
Oh my God, unbelievable.
That defied
all physics.
Yeah, so that has to be in there as well.
You've got a quick hit in the Racing Post?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just think, folks, that if you like your golf and your Ryder Cup, and it's not about odds here. It's not about betting or whatever. It's about... There's really, really good previews here from Steve Palmer and the Racing Post, but just like the stats and everything. The strong leadership can help Europe become regainers, about Brexit joke about leave and remain or regain. But the team with the best world ranking average has won just 3 of the last 11 editions. This is about the United States. And 7 of Thomas Bjorn's team played in the last French Open. This is at Le Golf National. 3 of them finishing in the top 8. Only 3 Americans have played at Le Golf National, and only one of them, Justin Thomas, has made the cut. Course familiarity will that matter this week.
Right, that's a good start. We will get into that in a lot more detail later on. Nathan Murphy will also be joining us live from Paris. So PwC have enhanced their sponsorship of the All-Stars with their new PwC All-Stars app, which will allow GAA fans and the Gaelic Games media to keep right up to date with all the latest All-Stars related news, while also providing a comprehensive archive of all All-Star teams from the awards inception right the way back 1971. So the PwC All-Stars app will be available to download later this week from the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store. Jack McCaffrey and Kyle Hayes were both named the PwC GAA GPA players of the 2018 All-Ireland Football and Hurling Finals. We'll bring you our chat with the Limerick star Kyle Hayes tomorrow morning. But first, here's Jack McCaffrey on Life with the Dublin Footballers. Jack McCaffrey, how are you?
Hey, Owen, how are you getting up?
Not too bad. It has been, I think, a month since the All-Ireland final. Is it one of these years now where you're like, okay, I've got the hang of this. I know exactly how to deal with winning an All-Ireland. I can actually soak it all in and just relax and enjoy being an All-Ireland winner.
I don't think it's something that you ever really get the hang of, but the last couple of weeks have been really special. Like the satisfaction that's come with this year and the kind of pride in how things went throughout the season. It's been great to be able to kind of just sit back and, as you said, let it sink in and take stock of it all.
Yeah, because that is the one thing that you're so notable for in terms of enjoying it all. I know you've probably been told this 100 times in interviews before, but it is the smile on your face, it is the post-match interviews, the energy, the stuff that really kind of gets played down a small bit, or people are almost afraid to show that, I think, sometimes in modern-day GAA, but not with you. So with all this cocktail of things, you must be looking around at your current GAA career, to use that word, and you must be thinking, this is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it is great to have that couple of weeks kind of after a final to reflect on it from a more, like the initial, obviously, reactions and stuff, like you're kind of referencing, the energy and the excitement then, that obviously subsides and dies down, but it kind of is replaced by a deeper, nearly kind of more profound appreciation for what's going on throughout the season. So, while I'd love to recapture that buzz of the kind of half an hour after the final whistle goes, I don't think I'd change this feeling for much, to be honest.
Yeah, I wonder, does it come from what happened in the All-Ireland final last year, that injury? Has that changed your perspective a little bit at all?
It was certainly something that played into it, Jack. Like this year, when I look back on this season, it was a very different one for me. The league campaign I wasn't involved in on the field. I did have to put in an awful lot of hard work to get back, and that's something that I, like, from a personal point of view, it couldn't have really come together much better for me.
Yeah.
And now I owe a massive debt of gratitude to our medical team and our physios, who left no stone unturned and were there with me every step of the way. But from that kind of side of things, that's something that also feeds into the satisfaction, I suppose, of it at the end. With regards to the final, I don't think it was too much of a factor. An All-Ireland final is such an event and such a day in of itself that you don't really need to pull on anything else to motivate yourself or to enjoy it.
True.
So I think it does that all by itself.
Yeah, what was the process of you being injured like at the time? Because obviously you've been an integral part of the whole camp down through the years. Does Jim have you involved in team meetings and stuff like that? Are you still around the place?
Yeah, so Jim was fantastic in terms of just giving me a bit of leeway myself, so I wouldn't have liked to just disappear for the entire league campaign and then arrive back, because you can't really expect to integrate back into the group that quickly. So the way we would have worked it was that I attended a fair few of the games and maybe helped out with stats and stuff, but throughout the week I'd pop up to training if there was a meeting before, kind of sit in the meeting, be aware of what way the game plan was evolving, and then I'd leave and just go off to the gym. There was no kind of expectation of standing at the side of the pitch watching the lads train,
sure,
which was fantastic, because that's the one thing that really would have killed me, to just watch lads get better and improve while you know, are perceived to remain in the same place, and you just get frustrated and probably push yourself too far in the wrong way. So it was an individual process within the group, if that makes any
sense. No, definitely. Yeah, it makes total sense. And I think after it all, I think it just adds to kind of the light that everyone, not just Dublin fans, had to see you back and smiling and playing well. And I think it was the Galway match when, I think you probably would admit this yourself, you were back at that point. Kind of like we say Tiger Woods is back at the moment. That was the moment when you were really in flow. And it was almost, I don't know, like I'm not sure what you were thinking during that game, but you must have just been delighted. I think the word you used after the game was buzzing.
Yeah, that was a great game. It was obviously an All-Ireland semi-final, and we'd prepared massively for it. Galway had a great year and are kind of really young coming team who are one of those sides that obviously respect you but have no fear of playing anyone. So, you know, we prepared really well for that. From my side of things, yeah, I played quite well that day, and it was probably the culmination of a couple of strong performances kind of improving day on day. So, look, that interview was 45 seconds after qualifying for an All-Ireland final. I will not be held responsible for anything I said.
Absolutely. Yeah. Don't be apologetic for a good interview ever. I know you're in a hurry, because I presume that your life outside of football at the moment is a pretty hectic one. It's a really interesting one as well. So you're finished with your studies at the moment in UCD. Are you on the wards now?
Yes. So I am working with the paediatric team up in Our Lady of Lourdes in Drogheda. Actually only for another week and a bit, and then I'm going to rotate to another team up there. So it's fantastic. It's a really good work environment, and I've really enjoyed it, but it's been a bit different, you know, having to get up every morning as opposed to the college lifestyle where you can go on as many holidays as you want and stay in bed if that's what catches your fancy. But it's been a very enjoyable kind of different challenge.
Yeah, you mentioned there that you're rotating around different areas. Is there an element of medicine that you want to specialise in?
Well, so this paediatric job is my first one I've done. I've really, really enjoyed it. So at the moment, that's what I would say I'd love to do. Now, I'm aware that I might come across something else that would change my mind, but paediatrics is just it's a fabulous environment to work in. The people you meet are just some of the most incredible people I've ever come across. So it's something I'd strongly consider, yeah.
Is it tough?
It can be tough. And I'm sure as you progress further along the career ladder and become more senior, it becomes tougher. At the moment, like, there's no, like, nobody's life is in my hands or anything. Like, I'm functioning as part of a team, but as a, you know, very junior member of it. So I can imagine, like, you do see some very tough things, but you come across that in every aspect of medicine. And the great thing about working with children is how quickly they bounce back, and their fantastic attitude that they kind of have about everything. So yes, it can be tough like anything, but it's also really enjoyable.
Absolutely. Like, we were speaking to Phil Healy, the Irish sprinter, there recently, and she said it was really tough being on the wards and then going to training. It strikes me though that that's not going to be the same thing for you, because just from listening to some of your teammates talk about the importance that gym puts on your career, is that there are not allowances made, but certainly there's a big understanding for what you do and that being the most important part of your life.
No, I think it would be fair to say there are allowances made. Like, we've lads in the team who might have to travel occasionally because of work, and like, the trust is there that nobody is going to use it as an excuse to get out of anything and say, oh, I have a work gig and take the piss with that.
Yeah.
Everybody like is fully committed to the Dublin team, but it's just an unavoidable part of life in an amateur sport that you have a profession, and as you touched on, like, Jim is very keen on the work-life balance. Like, even Jim and other members of the management team will miss sessions occasionally because they've work commitments, and everybody understands that. We're all in the same boat, and we're all, like, I don't think you can question anybody's commitment because they miss something due to work. They're fully on board, and everybody understands that.
And success breeds success in both areas. One final point. Very serious allegation put your way by Eamon McGee on Twitter that you're a fan of the Star Wars prequels. What's that about?
I think, like, they're good. They're a bit wordy sometimes, but you know, some good fight scenes. They were, you know, they're the reason I enjoy Star Wars, so I can't hold a grudge against them. Some of the recent films have...
Jack McCaffrey, how are you?
Not Jack McCaffrey, but it was Jack McCaffrey's voice, and that's all that matters. Darren Cleary, how are you?
Good morning, Owen. I'm very well.
What's going on?
Tiger Mania, John. Are you excited by Tiger Mania?
What's the mania?
Is it running wild?
Are these kind of like quips?
Tiger Mania
the lion sleeps tonight.
Tiger Mania is the result of Tiger's first tournament victory in 5 years, but Rory McIlroy says Team Europe will not be distracted by Tiger Mania. His first tournament victory, of course, has given them a big boost ahead of the Ryder Cup. The American on the playing side for the first time since 2012, having been a vice captain in 2016, he has a record of 13 wins, 17 losses and 3 halves in this competition. Woods has only been part of one victorious Ryder Cup team from 7 appearances, and McIlroy says his childhood hero cannot be their sole focus.
That is not Tiger Woods.
That is not Rory McIlroy.
Oh, sorry, Rory is who you were going to play there. What did he say? Do you want to give us the gist? Or
the gist was, there's a lot of good players there. They're all playing in pretty decent form. So as good as Tiger is, we cannot afford to focus on Tiger.
John was making that exact same point earlier on. I'd say Rory just didn't want to repeat what John was saying.
This is all just talk. Once that first ball is hit tomorrow morning, it'll be all forgotten.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be. It is, like, is it a better situation now that the rest of the world is kind of suffering from a USA / as you say, transatlantic dominance at the moment? Because, like, Paul McGinley's making the point that statistically this is one of the best European teams ever. You make the point that this is one of the best USA teams ever. Like, it's both of those things are married with the fact that outside of the USA and Europe right now, things aren't going so well.
Yeah, but I don't know if people in South Africa or Australia are necessarily going to care. They're just going to see good entertainment and good golf for a few days in a close contest. People just want a close contest. Even ourselves, we want a close contest. We can't really see Europe running away with it like they have done Darren and Owen in the past. So, no, I think we just want to see a bit of excitement and players to do justice themselves, you know.
Meanwhile, an Instagram post could result in Manchester United selling their record signing in January. Sky Sports cameras captured the tense exchange between Jose Mourinho and Paul Pogba the day after the United manager stripped the midfielder of the vice captaincy publicly in front of his teammates. Pogba posted an Instagram story. I'm not sure we can bring it
down. We do, yeah, we have everything.
But it was moments after the penalty defeat to Derby County in the League Cup. Now, in this Instagram story, he's joking and laughing with Luke Shaw and Andres Pereira. Take a look.
Why this smile?
They're clearly laughing at Luke Shaw.
They are clearly laughing at Luke Shaw, but I think Mourinho's point is they're in great form and laughing despite the fact the team have just been eliminated from the League Cup. I know, but you would expect the players, or Mourinho certainly it seems would expect the players to carry themselves with a certain decorum, and whether or not you're involved, you should be pissed off if your team loses to anyone, I would assume is his argument. The suggestion is, according to a number of reports this morning, is that was the row of training, that Mourinho was agitated by that. When Pogba came up to him, Mourinho made some kind of snide remark about the Instagram story. Pogba, taken aback in the footage we saw from training, and made the point that it was actually Wi-Fi issues in the stadium and that he had posted the video an hour before, but because it never got out of the Wi-Fi, it only came up at about 10:30.
Right, okay.
So he says he wasn't laughing immediately in the aftermath of the loss. He was laughing an hour before they lost. Now, Liverpool legend and Sky Sports pundit Jamie Carragher has been speaking about this, and he feels there's only one winner in the fight.
It looks like it's Mourinho or Pogba. Who do I see in the right between these two? Jose Mourinho. They've both been there exactly the same amount of time, 2 years. I think Jose Mourinho's done more than Pogba in that time. Now, another question is for Jose Mourinho, should he be getting more out of a £90 million player or other players? But in terms of this, Paul Pogba, I don't know if Pogba is worth the hassle for what he gives on the pitch. And there's an idea that it's one or the other. So if Mourinho goes, we'll see a new Pogba. You won't, I can assure Manchester United fans, you won't. No one plays for 2 years and then all of a sudden you change your manager and it's a different player. We're seeing what Paul Pogba is as a player.
What is he?
And, well, he's not as good as he thinks he is. He's not. He's got talent. But his big problem is his understanding of the game. It's been a problem since he came and it hasn't changed now.
Now, Liverpool lost for the first time this season. They were knocked out of the League Cup last night. The Premier League leaders went down 2-1 at home to Chelsea. Tottenham secured their place in the last 16 by overcoming Watford on penalties. Alexander Lacazette had to come off the bench to help Arsenal seal a 3-1 win over Brentford at the Emirates Stadium. West Ham had no such issues, hammering Macclesfield Town 8-0. Daryl Murphy hit the back of the net, bit of a screamer for Nottingham Forest as they were 3-2 winners over Stoke City to secure their spot in the next stage of the competition. While in rugby, the Munster head coach Johan van Graan says they cannot offer any update on a Conor Murray situation at the moment. Murray's been out of action since the third test of Ireland's victorious summer tour in Australia. He's missed Munster's first four games of the Pro 14 season. Van Grand says he wants to protect his medical information.
Look, I can't comment on Conor's injury. I respect his request to not speak about his injury. I've been open and honest about that from the first day. All that I can say is in a very good headspace. He's training on the side of the field with our rehab staff. He's smiling. He's enjoying himself. And he's working incredibly hard. So things look very positive, but we'll just take it day by day. And as soon as he's declared fit, we'll definitely draft him into our team. You know, he's one of our best players, and he's one of the players that must make Munster tick on and off the field. So we desperately need him. However, player welfare is number one. Whenever I'm the coach, I'll look after my player as well. And as soon as he's ready, he'll be back on the pitch.
Yeah, Johan van Graan there speaking about Conor Murray. Darren, thank you for that. It's time to get nostalgic for the Ryder Cup. Flashback to 2006, I should say. First up, here's John Duggan and Today FM live from the K Club as Europe were crowned Ryder Cup champions on this very soil.
Live from the K Club, good afternoon, I'm John Duggan. Europe have won golf's Ryder Cup for an unprecedented third successive time. They've done it on Irish soil, and not only that, they're going to annihilate the United States of America. Joining me with the details here in County Kildare is Conor Morse.
Well, chasing a 10-6 overnight deficit, 45,000 people came to the Palmer course here at the K Club today. Every single one of them expected a big American fight back. Well, it simply has not materialised. Instead, what we've all witnessed is a succession of heroic performances from each and every one of the European team on singles day. The winning stroke around 15 moments ago fell to the Swede Henrik Stenson. He sank a 10-footer for par on the 15th, and that wrapped up an emphatic 4-3 win over the rookie Vaughan Taylor. Seconds later, as captain Ian Woosnam was on hand to offer a warm hug and congratulations as the packed galleries already began the celebrations. Tiger Woods briefly reduced the gap to 3 points with a 3-2 win over Robert Carlson. Paul Casey sank a 25-footer for birdie on the 17th. That beat Jim Furyk 2-1. David Howell holds 4 birdies in a row to beat Brett Wetherick 5-4. And moments ago, Darren Clark burst into floods of tears after closing out a 3-2 win over Zach Johnson. Americans and Europeans in the crowd alike clapping and cheering the big Dungannon man. What a week it's been for him. Elsewhere, Paul McGinley still out on the course. He's all square with JJ Henry. Jose Maria Olazabal, their veteran, 2 up against Phil Mickelson. Lee Westwood 3 up against Kristen Marco. Patrick Harrington 3 down to Scott Verplank. Europe have won the Ryder Cup. It's been emphatic, comprehensive and conclusive. Clark, Garcia, Westwood, Casey, just some of the heroes over the 3 unforgettable days here at the K Club. It's 3 in a row for Europe, and for the first time they've won all 5 sessions. 16 points to 8 as it stands, and it's going to be even more promising than that.
Well, Conor, it's the result every Irish sports fan hoped for. It's capped off an unbelievable week for everyone associated with the event, and what a victory for captain Ian Woosnam and his players.
Fantastic. Woosnam took a lot of stick coming into this tournament over selections, over the style of captaincy he was going to have. He's been vindicated in each and every one of his decisions, from the pairings on the first day through the second day. His two wild cards have carried this team. Darren Clark and Lee Westwood superb throughout, and if we just look up at the scoreboard, Darren Clark a 3-2 winner, Henrik Stenson 4-3, David Howell 5-4, Olathabal's 2 up, Westwood's 3 up, Luke Donald a 2-1 winner. Paul Casey has played superbly all week, and as it stands, John, at the moment we're leading by 16 points to 8. 2 years ago in Michigan it was a record margin of victory, 8.5, 9.5. It's probably going to be exactly the same as that. It's been emphatic and conclusive, and there's going to be some party around Kildare, across Ireland and throughout Europe tonight.
18.5 to 9.5 is exactly how it finished on that day. Happy memories.
The great Conor Morris of Air Sport fame now.
Yeah.
Of course, Conor was a commentator and presenter, and enjoyed working with him and with everybody else down there that week. Paul Collins as well was down there. And yeah, so it was a magical week for Today FM. We had a studio by the lake.
Oh, nice.
So we saw Darren Clark's first tee shot, and we saw Tiger Woods hit it into the lake on the first morning, and it was just it felt so seismic and so big.
Yeah,
I was at the Belfry 4 years before that on my own, but that felt really like, whoa, this is a major event coming to Ireland, and hasn't been repeated since. And of course we'll have the Open Championship on the island of Ireland next year, but that was something else, and hopefully we get it back.
Clark was amazing that week.
He was, yeah. I think he channeled really difficult emotions very positively. That tee shot was so difficult, I'm sure, for him. And the roar when he hit it and he smoked it down the middle of the fairway. Yeah, it was, and of course, he was celebrating them with a pint of Guinness, I think, on the balcony about an hour after they won. So, yeah, he was brilliant.
So what we often see, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the influencer game on Instagram, but a lot of people do unboxings.
Paul Pogba do it, doesn't he?
He probably does. He probably does unboxings of his shoes and unpackings of, I don't know what they do. But
Barcelona shirts.
You're going to become Off the Ball's very first influencer here because you're going to do an unpacking of the media kit given to you in 2006 at the K Club.
Yes, well, I got a Ryder Cup tie. Very nice. I don't think I've only worn it about a handful of occasions, so there's no kind of curry stains or anything on it. Ryder Cup tie. I actually only found this, Owen. I was doing a kind of a spring clean. I found a Ryder Cup radio. Now I know people don't really use these kind of things anymore, even though you should listen to the radio. So Ryder Cup radio, and it's like in pristine condition. So yeah. You can tune in to the right frequency. After Off the Ball AM is over.
Of course.
So it's a Ryder Cup radio, and yeah, I've got this pack. So obviously you've got passes. I'm one of these anoraks that I keep my passes, you know, practice ground pass, like to see players in the practice ground.
Yeah.
Then the mugshots, I call them the mugshots. This is the one from the Belfry from 2002. Definitely would be a wanted man. €10,000 reward for this horrific mugshot. From 2002, a little bit less threatening. 4 years later, with Today FM for the K Club Ryder Cup. So yeah, you have these kind of, well, I don't know what these things are called, but
lanyards.
Yeah, you keep them, and they just had all these kind of quirky things that they gave you. A Ryder Cup mouse mat.
Wow,
which I've never used, so I probably never will own.
No, they're certainly gone out of fashion.
They have, yeah, and I know how to use a mouse these days. They had like things like, you know, the daily draw sheet for the players. I'm sure all this is going on. Nathan probably has all these, and Joe in France right now. Spectator guide for the K Club, the official program of the event.
Class.
I'm not a programs person, but it's nice to have that. And then, like, what I really enjoyed was stamps. You were given stamps,
right?
So
have you used them?
No, I haven't used them. You know, of Irish golfers. You know, you see their Patrick Harrington is there. They've got you know, the balls of error and all that kind of thing. And actually, at the very back, they've got ones that actually, you know, kind of, I don't know if you can see it. You can see the sand in the bunker and the ball moving in the bunker. So for all those stamp collectors, yeah, I don't know, in maybe 50 years' time, they'll be worth billions of dollars.
I'd say they're worth a good bit already.
Yeah, well, I haven't actually opened them since then. So I'm just one of these weird anoraks when it comes to memorabilia and these kind of things. And I keep everything that I think is important. So I don't have any balls. I've got a mug at home, but I don't, bizarrely, the one thing I don't have is a golf ball from the Ryder Cup in 2006. But I think when you have these events like the Open next year on the island of Ireland or the Irish Open at La Hinch, you know, I'll be definitely collecting more things, because to me, I remember somebody said to me once, well, you've got a box of tickets, so what? I've got a box of tickets that are just life experiences.
Yeah.
And I think that life experiences are what actually keeps us going. So the K Club was such a great week, and hopefully the Europeans will do it again in Paris.
That's got to be your fondest Ryder Cup memory.
Yeah, personally, what I experienced there, it was great that Today FM, we went down there for the week. We did all of our bulletins, our sports news down there for the week from the K Club, and we were really part of we did like bespoke shows. We did the Premier League live from down there. On location, which was great. We had Arnold Palmer on. We'd remember George Kimball, the great writer, America at Large, who sadly passed away. So everybody was there. Everybody that, you know, you could speak to or would want to speak to was there. The Last Word was broadcast from there, and Ian Dempsey and everything. So I think for these things, you need to embrace it. And it's very rare. And that's why even with the talk of Ireland playing World Cup games, possibly in 2030, these things are so rare. They don't come around very often. And that's why I kept everything, because I do think it is actually a part of our history, our sporting history.
What's your first Ryder Cup memory?
I think my first Ryder Cup memory is probably, I remember seeing the Sam Torrance putt from 85 when he had the pencil behind the ear. But I don't think I saw that live. So I think really the first one that I really got into was 87 when the Europeans won for the first time in America. Tony Jackton was a great captain. They won in Ohio. But the first Ryder Cup I really remember, I think you can be passively remember it, but then you can actively remember something. So I really remember the 1991 War on the Shore.
Good first one to remember.
America had not won in 8 years. And the Gulf War was on the time. And this was, I think, the first time we saw the Americans really buy into it because they did not like losing. I think Con Hoolan once wrote that Americans don't like draws in sport. They don't do draws because they can't cope with either winning or they have to win. And they weren't winning. And there was a huge pressure on the 25,000 people in South Carolina, the Kiwa Island Ocean Course. You had George Bush giving messages. The Gulf War was on. You had Corey Pavin wearing a camouflage cap. And it just was so dramatic. You had Seve coughing when his opponents were hitting tee shots. This kind of thing, gamesmanship. Nick Faldo didn't have the best of weeks. And it got down to the final day. Americans had a clear lead. Mark Halkovecki completely choked, lost the run of himself, spraying his shots into the water. And it came down to Hale Irwin and Bernhard Langer. And Langer had a six-footer on the last for Europe. Because if you draw in the Ryder Cup, you keep the trophy. Mm. So like, if the United States draw against Europe this week, they keep the Ryder Cup. Langer had that put to retain the trophy and he missed it. And then you could see the agony in his body, sear through his body when he missed that put. And you're just a young lad at home going, oh my God, we've lost it.
Yeah.
And then it changed then. Brookline was a great memory.
99.
Yeah, because of just the I think Brookline and Medina, because they were both in America and they both had a different flip at the end. You had that Justin Leonard put and everybody going mad when the United States won. Colin Montgomery was given an awful stick. Payne Stewart was great, very gracious to I think they were 10-6 down, if I remember. Europe, what I know about that tournament is that Mark James put all of his best players at the end. He made a complete mistake.
Yeah, it was kind of opposite, wasn't it? That the Americans, they obviously finished with their best players. The Europeans started. And 10-6 was the score for heading into the final round.
Yeah, so he made a mistake that he put all the best players at the end, which was a fatal mistake. And whereas we saw in 2012, the miracle of Medina, I think Europe were 10-6 down. And they came through and blitzed him in the singles, and you had Martin Keimer with that winning, and then Al Athabal's tears for Seve. So there was almost like a hidden hand there. But there've been some. I think the Ryder Cup has almost matured because as a golf fan and as a sports fan, you really felt that this was a real statement of pride as a European, because we had Seve, we had Sandy Lyle, Ian Woosnam, Nick Faldo around that time. Mm. And winning the Ryder Cup was such a seismic thing, and that breakthrough in the war on the shore was such a battle. And then they won in 95 with Philip Walton, had that winning putt at Oak Hill. But by the time it got to the 2000s, Europe were winning, like in it, annihilating the United States twice. Yeah. 18.5 to 9.5 in 2004. And then 2006 at the K Club, 18.5 to 9.5. So you almost felt a degree of a bit sated.
Yeah.
And you almost want the Americans then to win again.
But the great irony was that this was peak Tiger. And this also coincided with peak Europe in the Ryder Cup.
And Tiger was, and Phil Mickelson, going out in the first morning in 2004, paired with Hal Sutton. They were so competitive at the time that they weren't that close. And you could see the tension all, you know, and the pair of them were a mess. Mm. And Langer and Harrington, it was Langer, the captaincy. It was Harrington and Montgomery that won that morning that set the tone for the whole. Montgomery has really made it as a captain, as a player, something that has been a real quest for him. But I felt as a sports fan sated by those two wins in 04 and 06. And I didn't mind America winning it from time to time, because there was a feeling there for a while that Europe were winning these all the time because they cared more about it, did more spirit, and the Americans were just a bunch of individuals put together for a week. But as we saw in the last tournament in Hazeltine, that the Americans have got that unity and that sense of purpose, and they were blowout winners the last time. But with, I think what happens with the Ryder Cup is the changing of the captains cannot be underestimated. To me, you know, I know that there's this kind of policy of rotation and giving everybody a chance, but a good captain necessarily won't be followed by a good captain.
Mm.
And I can see the influence of the captains positively and negatively on results. So that takes a little bit of the consistency away from the events. And to me, it kind of lessens the event a little bit. But as a European golf fan, I don't feel the need to prove myself or as a fan to beat the Americans anymore, because we've done it.
Yeah, I do wonder how things changed after Brookline in 99, because I wish I was old enough to actually kind of remember this in full flow, because the way I see it, if you kind of chart history, the joy we get out of Europe winning the Ryder Cup is more to do with beating the USA than it is with this sort of continental glorification of success in a golf tournament. And I think 99 was the moment that we all looked at the Americans, you know, the invasion on was the 17th.
Yes.
Like, I mean...
And Sam Torrance saying that, Tom Lehman, you're not a man of God.
Yeah.
and he challenged him, and then Tom profusely apologised and this kind of stuff. I've never seen something... like, because it went against, as we were speaking at the top of the show, against everything that golf is meant to be.
Yeah, it's great.
Which is this kind of gentlemanly... you never cheat. The rules are very, very precise. Mm. And sometimes I find when I go to a golf tournament that I just see these guys who are not short of comfort, a little bit in their own world, in their own bubble. So I think that the team nature brings out the visceral emotion of a young guy who used to be a guy playing against his mates for $50 in college. And that is a good thing, I think, about the Ryder Cup. It brings the players a little bit more down to earth in conjunction with the fans. And I think there's a good connection there.
The thing is, as well, that the legacy of 99 was, you went to 2002. And I don't know, I think when you look at sort of the cultural appropriation of the 2002 Ryder Cup, I think that's as big as it's ever got. Like Tony Blair talking about the Ryder Cup and saying, oh, well, what about the Ryder Cup? And he was talking about, I think he was at loggerheads with George Bush at the time about invasions in the Middle East or whatever. And this had suddenly came up in the House of Commons, the Ryder Cup win. And I don't think we'll ever really get to that level again, that the Ryder Cup's actually brought into like the political sphere. Or maybe we just need kind of more golf fans in leadership around the world.
Well, Donald Trump is a massive golf fan. Yeah, I'm sure he'll be tweeting about it this weekend. Yeah, because I wasn't there one of these, because he had so many anecdotes about Trump that, don't talk to me, I want to watch the Masters, was one of the things I heard. So he definitely could tweet about it in the next few days, Donald Trump, especially if the Americans win. I expect he would.
Yeah.
The 2002, there was a degree of solemnity after the 9/11 attacks, and Europe won it quite easily. But I think the great leveller of the Ryder Cup is that, do you know who Philip Price is?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So, but would everybody on the street know who Philip Price is? Maybe not.
Probably not. But is that like a golf thing, or is that a wider sporting thing?
No, but I think most people on the street would know who Henrik Stenson might be.
Sure.
But Philip Price beat Phil Mickelson easily in the singles. So I think that there's a democracy, and I think that has a lot to do with the momentum, the team spirit, the chemistry, and riding that wave. And that's why we see that the Americans have only won twice on this continent since Europe came into the competition in 1981 at Walton Heath and in 1993 at the Belfry.
Yeah, we'll get into more memories in a little while. Maybe go from 2004 onwards. 2004, like the idea of Woods and Mickelson being absolutely crap on that first day. We'll get into that. We'd love to hear your Ryder Cup memories as well. You can tweet us at Off the Ball or comment on the stream if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube. We're just going to take a little break for a while because world champion and Olympic roarers Gary and Paul O'Donovan popped into studio yesterday around the launch of FBD Insurance's sponsorship of Team Ireland. The sponsorship will come into effect immediately until the end of 2020, running until the end of 2020, and encompasses all of the Olympic Federation of Ireland's activity, both in Ireland and internationally. An exciting partnership for both FBD Insurance and the Olympic Federation of Ireland, illustrating FBD Insurance's commitment to local communities from which Olympic heroes emerge. Here's how we got on with Gary and Paul O'Donovan. Delighted to say Paul and Gary O'Donovan join us in studio. Lads, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much.
I'm not sure were you complimenting us on our memorabilia, but we were having a conversation about it anyway. You're not too big into your memorabilia or too sentimental about some of the stuff you've used from what I can gather.
Not hugely, no. I think you just kind of get on with it, to be honest. And
maybe when we're old and retired and trying to find our old kit, we might reminisce on it then, but at the minute... not so much.
It's noticeable our lack of rowing equipment in here at the moment. Like, I'm not suggesting anything, but we do accept all donations here.
Yours and both might be a bit big to get in here, but...
Yeah. You were saying that you've had some very...
There's a really nice picture on the wall up here. Look, you can see there's just three of us in it. Two of us, no. Mm-hmm. It's like one of those motion pictures. It's a bunch of rowing memorabilia. I don't know if you can see it on the camera or not, but...
Screen shot. I guess the first thing to say is congratulations, welcome home. How does it feel to have won it together? I guess it's a different experience, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fine all together. Yeah. You don't think about it much, to be honest. How does it feel? And
yeah, like at the time, it's fierce exciting, you know, and you're building up to it all week. You're racing in the final. You're going through all your preparations, and then you're going to execute the race. And once it's done, it's like overwhelmingly exciting.
You'd be a bit excited there after about an hour and a half or something, and
you have to go straight. I spent 2 hours sitting in a room doing the drug test, and then straight after that, then you have to go back and take the riggers off the boat, put the boat in the bag, load it on the trailer.
Yes, because you did all that.
And
good man.
Well, I had to go and take a pee, like, give me a break. And then, but then you go back to your hotel and it's like time to pack the bag and hit, get in the airplane and come home and stuff. So like it all just dies down really, really quick and you get home then and you're just, you know, there was a fierce excitement again at the airport, but at that stage we were wrecked because we'd been travelling for 12 hours and two flights and a layover and the whole lot. And you're just like, oh, I just want to go home to bed.
Yeah. I'm sure you were out the night before as well, like, so you would have been very wrecked.
Wrecked.
Oh, yeah.
Wrecked.
Yeah. Big night out the night before the final, so that worked in our favour then when the Norwegians, one of them didn't show up. But I know we weren't out at all. Yeah, I'm kind of surprised but many
you know
what, people actually believe that.
So am I, yeah.
On this show, like, I think it's given, like, the people understand.
Yeah.
We didn't go out the night before the World Championship final.
Sure some people just have
the amount
clue
of people that legitimately think we were out on the piss the night before the final.
Really, yeah. Like, we've come put on. Everything in our lives this year towards this one day and we're going to go out in the tear.
17 years of rowing, like.
What would happen out of interest if you did go out the night before? Like, have you ever done that? Got underwater with a little bit of a sore head?
No, and again, in training, like. No, you wouldn't really for racing. No.
Even training, I'd imagine it'd just be hell. It's not worth
yeah,
it.
Yeah, like usually if you're going out with your friends, like if we go home to Skibbereen and we're heading out with the lads, we usually try and time it into it if we have a day off. So like we try and take a day off once a week or once every second week and you try and time your social nights or whatever with the day off.
It's difficult and then sometimes the timing doesn't work out and you're just trying to make sure the coach doesn't find out.
Yeah.
He always knows. But you're not going to be recklessly slower. Like we'd still be somewhere in the pack, but you'd be unlikely to win it anyway if you did go on the tear.
Well, we won't test that hypothesis anyway.
No, probably best not to do so. Like, it's just striking, though, how sometimes the rowing calendar, even just from kind of our outlook on us looking from the outside in, is sometimes a bit strange. Like, the obvious example is 2016, the way you had to come straight back to this side of the world for the World Championships after that. Mm. Little time to rest in your laurels and even less time to actually go and have a few casuals to celebrate.
Well, that's the thing. Well, in Rio, I think I went out. I was there for two nights after the final, so I went out those two nights and then went and started racing then the following week in Rotterdam and you got on fine and you just, they weren't reckless nights out like that, you're on the floor, which is a silly thing to do anyway. You try and avoid that regardless of being in sport or not, but it's, you recover pretty quickly from it if it's kind of a sensible night, you know.
Yeah. Just thinking about this, like watching the World Championships recently, it kind of struck me that 2016, I'm not sure that you feel the same way, but I think anybody who was supporting anybody in the Irish team in any sport in the Olympics would have been kind of feeling that this is as good as it gets because we don't get to enjoy people competing for the podium consistently in Olympic events. So I think naturally, I after Rio thought this is as good as it'll get and it's great. But did you feel that at the same time? Do you feel that you're closer to your peak now than you were in 2016?
Well, we're always in ourselves, like, confident and optimistic. But, you know, we did the Olympics and you're like, that was a pretty good year. That was probably the best year. Paul won the World Champs. We had a load of boats in the final at the World Championships in Rotterdam. We had under 23 crews in the finals and we're like, that was a really successful year. It'd be hard to top that now.
Yeah.
Then the following year, we got two bronze medals at the under 23 World Championships. We got
three
European medals at the senior level. At the World Championships, Paul was first, at the pair was first, and Denise was sixth and Sunita was fourth. And then you're like, geez, that was a pretty good year. No, I mean, to be hard to do any better than that. And then we come along this year, and
two Olympic category boats, won the gold medals, and
four boats in the finals at the World Championships.
Yeah.
We have an under 23 world champion pair, we have an under 23 world silver medalist lightweight quad. We have a heap of more boats that are in. We've got four boats in qualifying positions. If they maintain their positions going into next year, they're in Olympic qualifying positions. And you're just like, well, how the heck are we going to? Does it get any better than this? And each year, like, the athletes are just getting more and more confident, more and more belief, and
more experience.
More experience. And more athletes are. It's not just like a handful of athletes are getting confidence and belief. More athletes are buying into this pool of success, and they're all kind of just channeling it from each other, and I think we're learning from each other, and I think a lot of the younger guys are learning from us as well. Like, I mean, we've got a load of knowledge and we're travelling the world and meeting new people and meeting Olympic champions and multiple world champions, and we're talking to them and we're trying to bring home that knowledge and feed it into the system and feed it into the young athletes and feed it to the coaches as well. And I think, you know, Dominic's doing a great job of proving, like, that. I think Dominic's one of the first Irish coaches that Rowing Ireland have employed in years and years and years, and he's like, I think, you know, I've always said that if the athletes have the belief and the confidence to go on because be successful on an international stage? Why can't the coaches do it? And you know, we're kind of proving that it's possible. And I think the coaches at home are becoming more and more independent and showing belief that they're good enough to bring the athletes to success as well.
Yeah, you're almost enabling them as such, that you were kind of the proof that Dominic was good enough sort of thing.
Yeah.
He must have felt not only delighted for you, but a real sense of confidence in himself.
Of course, yeah. Absolutely. But he never doubted himself either, you know. I mean, when we qualified, he was like, right, we'll go on now and we'll do well. We'll work hard for the year. And we were like, yeah, we'll go and do it. And there was no question of it being anyone else other than Dominic.
Yeah.
He never questioned him. He never doubted himself. He never doubted us. And we never doubted ourselves and we never doubted him. And like, you know, I think he's just showing that like Irish coaches can be good and there's no reason why they can't be.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. You mentioned they're going abroad and like learning things and passing them on to other people in Irish rowing. What sort of things are you learning?
To be honest with you, not a whole
basically,
while.
Basically, yeah. Basically, there's no real secret in the whole thing. Yeah. And like the New Zealanders and Australians and Norwegians, they're all doing very, very similar things to what we are. Say we might do 5-minute pieces, they might do 4-minute pieces. They're just tiny
the
little
concept is
differences
the same,
like
you know,
that. And then just a huge kind of volume of long, steady kind of mileage then around it. Some of them do weights and win races. Some of them don't do weights and win races. So there's just lots of different ways to do it. But I think you see a lot of them in Australia now have kind of centralised their system. So a lot of them are not able to go to college. And New Zealand is kind of that way. So what you're seeing is just
quick turnover.
Yeah, quick turnover of athletes. So they're just kind of getting in there for one cycle. And then at the end of that, whether they get the result or not, they're like, Jesus, I'll have to go and do something now with my life or else I'm really going to be left behind in your early 30s or something. Whereas
then you go talk to like the nations from Norway and Denmark, the smaller countries that are very similar to ourselves,
yeah.
The Dutch, and they're big on like let the athletes
go to university,
get a part-time job and do their training.
Yeah.
And like ourselves, like, you know, we were studying, I'd done my final exams in CIT in May before Rio. Granted, I'm in part-time, but I still was able to study and develop. And Paul's back in college now doing doing his post-grad degree and stuff. But, you know, it allows for a greater longevity in the sport, where you'd see, like, the bigger countries that are just centralising their programmes and forcing athletes to just row. They just get quick turnover. But then I think they have the ability to do that because they're bigger countries and they've got greater numbers and
bigger
greater membership.
And bigger funding and stuff like
but
that.
But, like, if you operate in that system,
could we? Probably could for a while, yeah.
It'd be difficult, but I don't think we'd have been able to do the studies that we have done and just keep looking to the future and try and get to as many Olympics as possible or that we want to do, you know?
Yeah.
But the fundamental principles of the rowing training, like for the 2,000-metre race, is standardised pretty much all over the world to little, tiny, little differences. And, you know, that's all, like, we're actually just learning and we're coming home and we're telling the athletes, like, what we're doing is no different to what the Kiwis are doing. It's just they've got it on a greater scale. Mm. They've got more athletes and more people buying into it. I mean, if you do what we do, it's the same as what the Kiwis do and you can be successful. And surely we're seeing our under-23s and our juniors are improving year on year. And when I was racing at under-23s, I was in a double with Shane and we finished 10th and 12th and our under-23s are finishing 1st, 2nd and 5th in the lightweight men's categories. And again, we're just like channeling this knowledge down and they're all buying into it and believing, right, this is the right way to do it.
When you go abroad, is this sort of a similar situation to the environment that you were nurtured in, that it is sort of remote areas here and there with a really hard-working community that are very passionate about this one thing, with no airs and graces really about them, but ultimately that leads to an absence of ego, which leads to a dedication that will lead to success? Or is it just really hyper-intensive?
To be honest, you see absolutely everyone from every walk of life, really and truly, like, you know, you get people coming from a working-class background, you get people who are coming from really wealthy families, but the beauty of it is, like, they're all coming into, say, this one rowing club somewhere, you know, you might have, and they're just equal, you know, everyone's the same. They still have to go out and do, what is it, like 30 to 40 kilometres a day, 8,000 kilometres a year, they still have to lift the weights in the gym, and it's just an interesting dynamic then as well, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Now, I did want to briefly just chat to you about your postgrad degree. It's in medicine. That's a bit of a kind of branch out. You were doing physio, was it?
Yeah. So I did physiotherapy. So I suppose in school I wasn't 100% sure what I wanted to do and I was kind of a bit interested in sports. And I was like, oh yeah, physiotherapy, I could do that and end up down the sports route then with that. But once I got into it then and started going through the years and the modules and all that, I just took a severe turn against the sports physio. But we had to do 1,000 hours of clinical placements in hospitals and places like that. I just really began to take an interest in what the doctors were doing, and I said, geez, yeah, I might give that a go. And then so I sat GAMSAT exams then and ended up in UCC, and they're actually giving me a Cuerca scholarship, so they've been kind of accommodating there with helping me get registered, because I was away on training camp when all that was going on and missed the first 2 weeks as well. And probably end up, say, there probably might be other clashes later in the year with regattas and exams or whatever, so it's kind of good to know that they're supportive as well of the whole sports side of things, which I suppose you do kind of need that, and it's good diversity for them as well as myself. Mm. But I'm kind of looking forward to the challenge as well, and it's another outlet as well that you're not just kind of totally consumed with the rowing, and because myself and Gary kind of spend so much time in the boat together, it's nice to get a break away from it and go and talk to some other people and do something else.
It's kind of important.
It is. And I think just for after life or later in life, when the rowing's finished, we won't be able to do it forever.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, so it's nice to know that you'll kind of have...
You can try it,
yeah. Certainly try. The interesting thing there that you mentioned, I think it must have been in that Red Bull mini documentary that was made about you earlier in the year, that I think it was you, Paul, that said you're happier away from civilization or something like that. It was obviously a tongue-in-cheek comment about Skibbereen, about the fact that, you know, so someone in the video says that, you know, there's no big buildings here, there's no clamour, or there's kind of no airs and graces really around the place. And the line that being happier away from civilization is quite an interesting one, because what you're talking about there is actually doing that thing where you're in when you're in your own zone, but then making a very big effort to actually get back into civilization and have a footprint in there as well. It's some balance to strike, isn't it?
But I guess in a way, it's each their own as well. Skibbereen is home for us, and if you talk to anyone in the world that leaves home, they always want to go home, no matter where it is.
Yeah.
And you could talk to someone who has moved to Skibbereen, might love it, but they always talk about going home to wherever that is. And it's just, I think it's like the nature of human beings. Like, you're fond of where you grew up and where's home. That's where you want to be.
I do wonder, did people at home ever get a bit worried that fame might have changed you in any way after 2016?
I'd say they're hugely concerned about
it. Hugely concerned.
Yeah.
They're all worrying about it at home. They're all watching this podcast.
And biting their nails. And
I think Gary said
it's getting, look at the way Gary's wearing his cap there. The fame's got the better of it.
We've done that before.
No. No, they're good in fairness.
They're
very supportive.
Anyway,
no, they keep us grounded as well.
To the corner bar, go up to Minahan's there, and they wouldn't be long dragging you back down to earth anyway.
I wonder, the whole dealing with thing, it kind of seemed to come very, very naturally to you, and I know you've spoken at length about it. Like, you've almost been interviewed about the interviews that you've done about Graham Norton and things like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, isn't it?
Interviewed about the interview.
Ask questions about the questions you answered.
Now, I'm sure Graham Norton will have you on to ask you about this interview and being in this set as opposed to being in this set now. I'm sure this is the next big step up for you. But it is quite a strange thing that there has been such a microscope on how you've been viewed, isn't it? I don't really recall anybody with that sort of scrutiny.
Yeah, it's a bit weird, all right, that sometimes people nearly forget that we actually raced at the Olympics and they just kind of think about the interviews, whereas we just try and forget about that type of thing and... Yeah. Get on with the rowing, because that's what we enjoy best.
But I guess,
has opened up a lot of opportunities for us.
Yeah, in hindsight, when you look back, it opened up a lot of doors and created opportunities, and it's given us a scope to promote rowing. Yeah. So we're getting these opportunities to come in here to this show, discuss our sport, and put it out there to the public and expose it to people, so that then, in theory, hopefully some more people some kids will listen, and they might say, oh, I'll give rowing a go, or some parents will listen and say, oh, why don't you go try rowing?
Yeah.
And then hopefully, 8, 9, 10 years' time, you'll start seeing greater and greater success in a bigger rowing team, and a big rowing just being a bigger sport in Ireland,
And that's the real success of it all, isn't it?
It is. I think, say, the likes of FBD now have started to realise that. So they came on board with us just after Rio, and we've been working as ambassadors for them. But then, say, after the whole summer we've had, where there's been loads of medals across a load of different sports, they were like, hey, what can we do now to, I suppose, try and capitalise on that as well and give it another boost? So they've kind of partnered with the Olympic Federation now of Ireland, and they've just launched a campaign today to announce that sponsorship. So I think...
But even a day like today, there's just been an opportunity for a whole bunch of different athletes
to get a platform to
expose their sports to the public through all different media platforms. And you know, like Sarah was in here a while ago just before us, and she was telling everyone about her experience and the success they've had at the World Championships. And you know, we're here now, we're telling you about our success at the World Championships, and we had Chloe down at the wherever we were earlier there with all the press and stuff, and she was telling us about their hockey championships, and you're just like, this is just amazing. And then, you know, you have to say, like, fair play to FBD and the Olympic Federation for putting this show on for us to do this and give our sports more exposure, you know?
Exactly. Like, I think when we look back on the summer of 2018, if we can call September a part of the summer, is it might actually be one of the most important few months that we've seen in Irish sport, because you mentioned it there, the hockey, the eventing. Can't really
the
call
European Championship was just in August, well, that kind of multi-sport
exactly
put together, so that gave great exposure as well for the little minority sports.
Sure, which
wouldn't
even count how many medals we won in there. We got a heap of them, you know.
That's it. Yeah, but the thing is, capitalising on it now, because, like you mentioned, FBD doing great work now in terms of pumping money into it.
Yeah.
The government money you get, obviously, you got the exact same grant this year as you got last year, despite the fact that there's more elite rowers. And to be honest, that needs to be looked at a little bit more, doesn't it? There can be a bit more done from the government funding as well as obviously trying to appeal to as many sponsors as possible.
That's the thing, I mean, but sure, all the sports and everybody across the world just wants more money, really, don't they? Sure. So everyone's kind of fighting for a piece of it. And when it's coming from the government, then if they want to push more towards sports, then you're taken away from healthcare or somewhere else in the budget. So it's kind of great then, just I should say, FBD is coming along then, just from the
corporate
the private
standpoint.
Sector.
Like,
What would extra funding do for you, or what is a lack of funding? What has that done this summer? Because you've had a few issues.
Say, well, not the word. Like, we had to miss one of the World Cup regattas earlier in the year, but then we had an opportunity. We were invited to go to Henley, which was just 2 weeks after that. So we took that up and got some good racing experience there instead. So we kind of made the best of that situation. And say, if you wanted to throw millions and millions at myself and Gary for the next 2 years, we're unlikely to get any faster in reality, you know. And so what more funding for rowing would do would help the rest of the team
create a platform to grow a bigger team,
so that you can just get a bigger fleet boat, so maybe more coaches, some more training camps for the younger guys, so that they can kind of bridge the gap up into the senior team, and the ones that are a little bit back off the pace, try and push them up into Olympic qualifying places and up then into the medals, rather than, say, making myself and Gary faster is kind of limited now, nearly by this stage. Of course, we can get
marginal world champions.
But yeah.
But then, the thing about it is, like, if this isn't happening and the team gets bigger and bigger, and you want to send more athletes to a world championships, the money isn't the funding isn't there to support it. So you have to compromise something else, and be that, like, do you upgrade the new fleet of boats, or do you hold off another year and use the?
Have you got a new fleet of boats?
There was some propaganda there a while back, and we don't know where it came from, that we were rowing in an old boat. Like, we get a new boat every year from the boat manufacturer.
Right, because I read that. It was like 4 years old was the actual.
We don't know what that was about.
Nonsense, I didn't really care.
That's mad, isn't it?
Our boat is fine. But even if we had a 4 year old boat, to be honest,
the boats are all the same.
Pretty
right?
Okay.
Yeah.
They're not going to be much slower, but I mean, to give everyone the best chance, some of the guys on the team probably did have a 4 year old boat or whatever age you want to call it. It wasn't brand new, say.
But what we were saying anyway, you know, if you want to send a bigger team, you have to get the money somewhere, so you compromise going to a European Championship, say, to prioritise the World Championship. So then you're minus one World Cup that we're already missing this year because of the growing team. Then you have to compromise something else to get to the World Champs and so on.
That was in the Olympic qualification area
at the venue,
Austria,
it's the same venue.
The World Championships are in Linz in Austria next year, and they had
second
a
World
bit
Cup
of a test regatta.
They're going to miss.
What can you do with that?
But say, I mean, we arrived out to Rio and had never been or experienced that venue before. So it's not the be-all and end-all. I mean, for sure, it would have been nice to go there.
We raced there in 2013. Paul got a bronze medal at the Under-23 World Championships there.
But just if you want to go and test out hotels and whatnot to make sure everything's up. But, I mean,
we're talking absolute ideal world scenario here, like where you want to go out, bring the whole team to all the events. Give the whole team the newest fleet of boats, but I mean, you know, this isn't an ideal world, and you still have to get on with it. And I mean, we could sit around for the last since we started rowing and moan and cry about the facilities and the boats and the oars and the funding and the transport and paying the levies, and we could cry about the whole lot of it if we wanted to, but what good is that? Like, I mean, we still have to get on with it. We still want to win the medal, and if we want to win the medal, we have to find a way to doing it.
you. It's great to have. Yeah. Lads, you've been so generous with your time, Paul and Gary. Thank you so much for coming in, and best of luck with the future.
Thanks for having us.
Cheers.
Paul and Gary O'Donovan joining us in studio yesterday, with thanks to FBD Insurance and their sponsorship of Team Ireland. So from the O'Donovan brothers to the Golf Weekly brothers, Nathan and Murphy and Joe Malloy have been sent to Paris. Nathan Murphy, you're first up. Good morning.
Good morning. How are we?
Very well.
Good morning, Nathan. Bonjour.
Bonjour. That's as far as we're going to go, John. It'll be a slippery slope.
Comment allez-vous, Monsieur Murphy?
Wait.
Tell us about Le Golf National, Nathan. It looks incredible. Your smug selfie yesterday was certainly very smug, but it had us all quite jealous.
I've never seen anything quite like it at a golf course. The second you walk in and you make the long walk from where they drop the supporters off, it is just this monstrosity. Everything is bigger, better than ever before. It seems to grow exponentially every time. That you think back to the K Club, as I was saying last night, it's almost like an amateur event now compared to this, compared to the size of the corporate facilities. And listen, golf is the most corporate game in the world, and they make their money this week. And everywhere you look, there's just giant grandstands, huge corporate facilities alongside the 15th, alongside the 18th. But I think it is that grandstand around the first that bends all the way behind the 18th green and the 15th green that's sort of blown everybody away. They're talking 7,000 people around the first tee. That is well over three times what was around Gleneagles. And I remember that first morning in Gleneagles, and it was an atmosphere unlike anything I've ever experienced before at a golf tournament, and that was less than 2,000. So triple that, and the pressure that's going to be on these players when they're staring out and there is this vast swathe of water down to the left-hand side. And the outshot, even down the right, is pretty heavy rough. It's one of the most daunting moments I'd imagine any of these golfers are ever going to have gone through.
Yeah, the general kind of theory, though, is that this is going to suit Europe, right? The tight fairways, I think Paul McGinley saying last week that the driver's only going to be out of the bag on the tee about four or five times on four or five holes. Is that true?
Yeah, that certainly seems to be what the statistics say from previous French Open, that generally five or six times per round is all you need your driver. It should suit the Europeans because they have more experience of this course. Half this American team had never even seen Le Golf National.
Oh, there goes the first Skype down of the week. Hopefully not the last, or hopefully the last, I should say, of our Skype problems. That is
sounds exciting, though.
It sounds amazing. It looks amazing. It just, I don't know, is it the grandstands? Is it the kind of infrastructure around the course that makes it look so good? Or was it just fantastic photography by Nathan Murphy there to actually
make
it?
No, the French know how to organise these things, and they've had a long time. I think the course has been there since 1919. It's the course they play there every year. But yeah, it's a city feel, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Nathan, you were talking to us about the course and the advantage it might pose for Europe.
Well, listen, home advantage is obviously huge. It's a quarter of a century since America last won a Ryder Cup on European soil. I think what might be interesting is actually that home support. So almost half the tickets have gone to French golf fans who are going to come along for the weekend as to how much they get behind the European team. Because this is actually the first Ryder Cup where there hasn't been a home player on the team. No French player really went close to get on this team. And you look at that American team, we're more familiar with them in many ways than some of these European players. I have a feeling that Tiger Woods, when he arrives on that first tee on Friday morning, will get the biggest cheer of the entire week, even though he is the opposition for this week. So I do wonder if it'll be the hostile atmosphere that we've grown used to, and actually is a brilliant part of it in America. I know a lot of people turn their noses up at it, but it's what you want this week. You want people's backs up. You want to see the emotion, like you saw from Rory McIlroy and Patrick Reed on the final day at Hazeltine a couple of years ago. So I think that might be just something to keep an eye on during the week, whether the support is as parochial and as pro-European as it may have been when we were at Gleneagles or Celtic Manor or at the K Club.
Nathan, when I was looking through the rankings last night, the best ranked American team ever, just over 11, the average in terms of the ranking. And when I was going through the form horses, I was going through each of the teams. I think the seven of the American players I counted in form. I think I only counted four of the European players that were really in form, and five European rookies versus three American rookies. Do America just have too much quality? That, despite the course, despite they're going away from home, they might just have too much quality over the next 3 days.
That's how I felt for the last 3 or 4 months. This is, as you say, statistically the best American team. And just when you look on paper and you go through the names, this is the best of the last generation, the best of the current generation. And these guys are going to dominate golf, you would imagine, for the next decade. Nine of them are already major winners. And it's not the strongest European team. As you say, quite a few of these players have seen a little bit of a dip in recent times. The very fact he's had to go back to Garcia and Stenson again and Casey for these wildcards suggests that there's not the new cream coming through and the new crop coming through that they really want in Europe. But over the past sort of 10 days, 2 weeks, having spent a lot of time watching Sky Sports Ryder Cup channel and looking back over previous Ryder Cups, they're always closer than you expect.
Yeah.
There's players turn up. Peter Baker turns up and wins 4 points. Thomas Peters turns up as a rookie and wins 4 points. Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods have losing records at the Ryder Cup. So everything you sort of look at on a weekly basis, I think if you were to put these players out on a regular golf course, you would fancy, on average, the Americans to finish higher. But the Ryder Cup, things change. Europe come together, they outperform. And by and large, the Americans have flattered to deceive at times a lot of these. But I think you even look at the pairings. It's so obvious and so strong, a lot of these American pairings. Like looking at it this morning, it looks as though they're going to break up Jordan Spieth and Patrick Reed. It'll probably be Tiger and Patrick Reed tomorrow morning in the four balls. Phil and Bryson DeChambeau. Unfortunately, we're not going to see Tiger and Phil in the four balls. Jim Furyk forward. A little bit of cold water on that this morning. But Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth have been mates for years. They're going to play together. Dustin Johnson and Ricky Fowler. Brooks Koepka and Tony Finau. You just keep rolling off the hits with this American team. And I don't think it's quite as clear-cut for Europe.
No, the counter to that, and another thing that McGinley said last week, is that this is, on paper, the best team that Europe have ever had. And it is. I think both of these things can exist in tandem. The fact that it is the strongest American team a lot of us will have seen, and also statistically the best European team we've ever seen. Mm. There might not be the glamour appeal to a lot of these European golfers, but statistically, you look at the rankings, you look at the rookies. I think the average world ranking of the rookies is 20th in the world. Like, this is a team, and there's no Ricky Fowler, Dustin Johnson's among them. But they are a team that have really proved it this season. And, like, I mean, you talk about Molinari earlier on, John, as the last time a European has won an event, really, an event of note. Like, there is an element here that this isn't just a dark horse European team, but a European team that probably expects to contend all the way down until the dying stages on Sunday evening.
Yeah, well, they always do expect to contend to the back nine on Sunday evening. I still just look at that team, and I know statistically, world ranking-wise, they've racked up the points and they've got themselves into good positions. I just still look at that team and look at Tyrrell Hatton, Alex Noren, Torbjörn Olsen. Are they at the level of those American players? I'm not quite sure they are. Is Paul Casey still at the level of those players? There's no question that a foursome pairing of Tommy Fleetwood and Francesco Molinari should be every bit the equal of whatever team they go up against. But Rory McIlroy is not playing well. He's been quite sullen the last couple of days, understandably so. Even Justin Rose, like I do wonder, Justin Rose has to be in a very good headspace in that 2 weeks ago he got to world number one. Last weekend he won 10 million quid. But at the same time, in both tournaments, sort of blew it, sort of underperformed. It's the most underwhelming way ever to become world number one, the way he finished the two shots the previous week. And then he went both Rory and Rose go head-to-head with Tiger, and they're blown out of the park. And like, Rory's general demeanour was interesting at his press conference yesterday and everything he was saying. Like, he was trying to almost laugh off what happened at Eastlake at the Tour Championship, but it's got to be hurting. He spent the last 5-6 years talking about wanting this moment of going head-to-head with Tiger, of going down a stretch with Tiger. And when it came, he flopped. It didn't happen for him. And Tiger blew him apart. And maybe this is the perfect scenario for getting over that. Maybe this is you go into that team room and everything feels good again. Or maybe actually you're just not quite as buzzed for a Ryder Cup as you thought you might be. But what happened 3 days earlier?
Well, hopefully, Nathan, when he sees that crowd tomorrow, that he will get buzzed and he'll be able to flip his emotions. Captaincy to me really matters. Langer, McGinley, great captains. Clark and Faldo, when I just saw them before the Ryder Cups they're involved in, I'm going to go, this is not going to go well. I've seen it on the American side as well. Azinger and Stockton were great captains. Hal Sutton, less so. Furyk and Bjorn, what's the kind of feeling on, first of all, their importance and also their qualities?
Yeah, I would agree that you can either be a very good captain and have an influence or a very bad captain and have an influence. Whereas maybe a lot of captains just sit somewhere in the middle, Jose Maria Lapadel. At Medina, was he a brilliant captain or did he just get lucky? You know, he was probably on the verge of being a terrible Ryder Cup captain that year. This week, there's been no great storyline of the opening 3 or 4 days. They both played it very, very safe. Like Thomas Bjorn was asked yesterday about his foursomes pairings. What makes a good foursomes pairing? Oh, you have to be a good golfer. Like, come on, talk about stating the obvious. Furyk, you know from watching him as a player, isn't really going to make a false step. He's going to be very steady. Again, I think because he has so much talent at his disposal. it's quite an easy job for him in working out who will play together and who the good relationships are. And I just can't see him getting things wrong. Even when it sort of started to gain momentum that Tiger and Phil would play together, I think Furyk sort of spotted that as more of a negative than a positive. Yeah, it'd be great. Listen, as a neutral, we would love to be here tomorrow morning, first tee, and it's Tiger and Phil. But I think Furyk has probably looked at that and realised, if they were to lose, what sort of a damaging effect would that have? Bjorn's steady, probably from people in the game, is Darren Clarke-ish in his attitudes to life, but he's kept very quiet. He hasn't said anything controversial. He hasn't stoked anything up. He said all the right things about Tiger Woods, about Phil Mickelson. Everything has just been pretty low-key from the two captains. But we were just talking about it earlier. Actually, when you think back to even 4 years ago, Gleneagles, the first two or three days of the Ryder Cup week are generally pretty quiet. It's only when we get the pairings this evening and serious questions and they have to explain themselves that maybe they can get a little bit tetchy. And when they go out tomorrow morning in the four balls, if you come in here and you're 4-0 down, as happened to Europe 2 years ago, you come in 3-1 down, then the attitude of everybody in the press room is very different to what it was on a Wednesday afternoon. And then I think you probably really see Furyk and Bjorn's character.
Yeah, we probably won't be able to map out exactly which way you expect it to go in terms of specific points until those pairings do come out. But what is your general prediction? It sounds like you're saying that it's going to be tight enough, but USA to win by maybe 2 points, Nathan. That's the sense I get from what you're saying there.
No. Well, listen, I think you want it to be close. That is the one thing about the Ryder Cup is it's a strange event in so many ways in that like it's not going to affect your emotions on Monday morning, whether Europe win or whether Europe lose. What you want it is to stir your emotions on Sunday afternoon because it's tight. And it's tense,
yeah.
And it's close. My fear is that actually this American team is the best American team ever, right. And they'll blow them out of the water. I'm going to go 16-12 USA.
Right, okay, USA. Well, we'll chalk that down as a Nathan Murphy prediction. Cheers.
Courage of your convictions, Nathan. Speak to you soon.
Lads.
The thing is, I'm completely fine with the USA hammering Europe, only if USA rub our faces in it. And Patrick Reed... like, rips his shirt open and...
reveals
like,
Superman.
Reveals Superman.
And it actually flies off.
That's it. And they
he's not actually on the plane. He lands in his cape on the other side of the Atlantic.
That's what we want. We want them to burn a European Union flag. We want them to like, throw bottles at the European Parliament at Brussels on their way home. Whatever it may be, we need some sort of passion shown from the USA team, like properly chanting USA, USA as they defeat it. And then I'm totally fine with us losing.
Well, I think you will get passion if they win here for the first time in a quarter of a century.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty guaranteed, but maybe not to the extreme level Owen Sheen that you secretly harbour for.
Well, that's all I want. Joe Malloy, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you doing, lads?
Very well. There is...
No, good morning. Bonjour.
Bonjour.
You've got the gleeful face of a man who's very, very excited.
Have you had your petit déjeuner yet, Joe?
Not just yet, John, but it's incoming.
Pain au chocolat?
Absolutely, yeah.
It's just random French utterances.
No. My French was good. There's a method in the madness. Clearly. There's a method in the madness.
Joe, what are you feeling? Are you excited? You look like you're excited.
Yeah. The Ryder Cup's a strange tournament, isn't it?
Yeah.
None of us on Monday morning will be feeling very sad over our déjeuner if Europe lose. You know, we're not. I sometimes liken it to a reality TV show, and you get so into it, and it feels so big. And then almost as soon as it's over, you kind of, well, I don't really care who won that ultimately. Anyway, there's a touch of that about the Ryder Cup. But at this point, as we're about to get really into it, it feels big and exciting. But yeah, it's a weird thing. I mean, the afterglow of a European victory, I don't know, you know, like on Tuesday or Wednesday, we'll be all saying, God, wasn't it fantastic Europe? I think what we all do is get a little bit into the Irish stories. So you think about the K-Club and you think about the brilliant images of Clark and you love to see Harrington doing well. And then 4 years ago, I mean, effectively, it was USA versus Paul McGinley. And that was how we framed the whole thing, you know. So I think it's almost, and everyone does this. I mean, I'm reading the English papers and the French papers, although the French don't have a player, obviously, but everyone picks out their own player. They want that player to do really well. They want Europe to win as a consequence. So it's a strange kind of tournament in so many ways.
Yeah, like it's interesting that you mentioned reality TV, because I'd certainly view it as sort of some sort of social experiment as well. And I'm not looking forward to the idea that this might be a very placid crowd, because I would be interested, sort of, as I say, a social experiment, to see how someone like Justin Thomas would react to a very visceral crowd. Because I'm sure you'll remember at the Honda Classic earlier on this year when a fan said, "I hope your shot goes in the water," and Justin Thomas got him kicked out for saying that. There's going to be a lot worse said, you'd suspect, at the Ryder Cup. Maybe not this year, but in previous Ryder Cups there's been said. And I'd love to see how someone who's I would call Justin Thomas a particularly precious human being. I'd love to see how he would react to some sort of comments like that in peak Ryder Cup.
Yeah, we've had glimpses before. Very famously, 4 years ago at Gleneagles, Patrick Reed gave the old shush to the crowd and really played up to it and got into it. And interestingly, I was listening. David Ginla was playing at that Celebrity Ryder Cup tournament that was on the other evening, and he was saying about 45-46% of the fans through the doors are going to be French, which is actually quite high. I think at Gleneagles, only about 35% were Scottish. So there'll be a big French contingent. It'll be interesting to see how they go about their business. I mean, it was interesting as well. Rory McIlroy was saying this week that 2 years ago, you remember him and Reed, that Sunday match, which was so incredible. You know, the first couple of holes especially, and Rory holed an unbelievable putt and, you know, gave it the all, "I can't hear you," and then Reed holed a putt back. Rory was saying this week that he's not going down that route.
But he looked ridiculous. He looked ridiculous.
Ah, no.
Well, I think
it was great.
I don't think it suited Rory McIlroy to be doing that. I think it suited Reed as the villain. I don't think Rory McIlroy is suited towards doing that.
Well, he said as much as anything, he got tired. You know, he said he's looked back at all the hooping and hollering and hands over the ear and shushing and fist pumping and screaming. And he said it's too tiring, that actually on the back nine, I mean, there's a reason McIlroy lost that match. One of the reasons is he just blew up. He was tired. He'd spent so much energy. And Paul McGinley was talking this week as well, and he was saying that one of the people he really was impressed with at Ryder Cups was Ian Poulter. So Poulter, we see the Poulter who goes nuts, and yet he said between matches in the team room, Poulter very quiet, conserving energy, having naps. McGinley was saying he doesn't even like seeing a table tennis. You know, table tennis competitions seem to break out of these things in both team rooms. They're a bit, you know, just killing time or whatever. McGinley was saying it's a waste of energy. Like, it's okay, it's good fun and everything, but it's, you know, it's competitive energy used up. And he was like, you need to rest. So Rory was saying he learned that 2 years ago in a big way, that he tried to take on the crowd a little bit and it burnt him out. So, yes, it will be, it always is. It'd be fascinating to see what the crowd are like. Generally, it's more hostile in the US, and maybe the Europeans feel, well, we need to up our game here. And then two, as you say, how the Americans would react to that. I mean, that's one of the weird, it's a weird tournament in many ways. That's one of the extra little weird things, is how the crowd are going to behave and how the players are going to behave back. It's not something we talk about too often ahead of a golf tournament.
Joe, you talk about Ian Poulter there, and he's been such a star at Ryder Cups. I think he's been the top points collector for three Ryder Cups. But who are going to be the stars of the 2018 Ryder Cup? Is it Tommy Fleetwood going to shine? Is it going to be John Rahm? Is it going to be Bryson DeChambeau, Tony Finau? Who's going to break through that we possibly haven't seen before at this, not individual golf, but at this stage of team golf?
I mean, it's such a tough question, and we're speculating, obviously. You would think John Rahm is the one who has a personality to really explode. You know, McIlroy was saying this week that when he played his first win in Celtic Manor in 2010, and in fairness, by his own admission, was a bit blasé about the whole thing, but he was saying he was quiet. You know, I'm the new kid on the block here. And he said in the WhatsApp messages over the last number of weeks, Rahm has been really forceful and giving his opinion and talking about strategy and how we should go about our business. And, you know, he's fiery and, you know, you just think there's all the ingredients that you want are kind of there for John Rahm to have a brilliant Ryder Cup. I mean, beyond that, that American team is just so talented, isn't it? It's kind of frightening. I think, in fairness to Bjorn, the reason he's picked experience is because it's just difficult to predict how those five rookies are going to do. And I know they're not quite rookies. Like McIlroy was saying, Rahm's a much better player now than I was in 2010 when I made my debut. But, I mean, how's Alex Noren going to react? You would presume well. I mean, he's
experienced. Well, he's won there.
He's won on this course. Everything suggests well. And yet we've seen people, they get in there and, I mean, the stand, I'm sure you're sick of people saying how insane this place is. I've never seen anything like it. Like, the thing is going from from humongous to bigger again.
What's the vibe? I mean, you're talking about David Ginola there. I think he's part of the opening ceremony. You're going to go down to that today, Joe. It's very syrupy and very grand and very polite and almost almost a beautiful you know, hors d'oeuvre to what we're going to see tomorrow.
Ginola polite?
The opening ceremony is polite. I think that was quite an accidental phrase, by the way. But is Paris a fitting host for this Ryder Cup, Joe, in your view?
Yeah, now I'm not here that long. I flew in last night and went to Versailles, but I was talking to a colleague on the bus over and he flew into Beauvais, which is no fun. No fun at all. We've all been that
last
soldier.
Bags, Joe.
Oh, listen. So he flew into Beauvais and I mean it's just interesting. Big cities swallow up even big events, and he arrived airport and kind of thought there'll be a desk of some sort or a bit of advice on the best way to get towards the course, and there was just nothing. You know, there wasn't even a dingy Ryder Cup desk in the corner which would give you travel advice. And he said, got into the city, again there was no real sense of this thing going on and no real almost help travel wise at various stations to get there. So he it's only when you get out here, which is maybe half an hour southwest of France, that you kind of start to feel it's going on. I mean, I'm really curious to see how the French crowd react. Will it be polite? I don't know, to a point.
Hopefully not.
I mean, I kind of hope not. It's not really.
They're
the point
passionate, sporting. I know Victor Dubuisson isn't here, or John Bell isn't involved as a vice captain, one of the 100 vice captains. But they're passionate about their soccer. They're passionate about their rugby, and hopefully they will buy into this.
Yeah, certainly. Joe, we'll get a quick prediction for you before we let you go. Nathan's calling it for a fairly healthy USA win. Yeah. What way are you thinking?
So torn. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure John's looked into the stats and is on top of this as much as anyone. Like on paper, if this is a neutral venue, you can't really look beyond that US team. It's been talked about as maybe the best of all time. The 1981 US team, for golf nerds, is worth having a look back at. I think in the end that those 12 players ended up with 45, 48 majors, something in that vicinity. The 81 team is a bit nuts, but this is certainly the best team since that, on European or US, and maybe the best of all time. I guess they kind of have to win and win big to almost justify that latitude. So on a neutral venue and with 5 rookies in the European team, you can't really look beyond the US team. And they're so together as well. You know, like I'm sure you saw Tiger Woods being greeted at the 18th on Sunday night. That is now a commonplace thing we see on the PGA Tour. The Justin Thomas, Jordan Spieth, Ricky Fowler, Bubba Watson brigade are friends. They go on holiday together. I mean, their Snapchats are kind of fun. They all hang out together. So there's a unity there as well. So the talent and the unity means it's very hard to go beyond the US. Obviously, home advantage is huge. 25 years is a long time. And this course, in so much as you can say it suits what is ostensibly a global field on both sides, but it does suit the shorter, straighter hitters. So that favours the Europeans slightly. I don't think it's going to be a washout. I mean, who knows with these things? And it's very unpredictable. If I'm going for anyone, it's the US, but only just because I really think, you know, home advantage is a massive thing. I mean, 1 to 2 points. I mean, I really think it'll be tight. I think it'll go down to Sunday. Hope it goes down to Sunday. And, you know, whoever wins is a great captain. Whoever loses was utterly terrible in every way.
Joe, bonne chance.
Merci beaucoup.
See you later, Joe. Thanks a million. John, which way are you calling it?
I've just had this brainwave come into my head that I'm trying to compare it to another sporting event. I remember the 1989 Ashes series between England and Australia in England, and Australia just made this statement, and I think the USA are going to make a statement this week and win for the first time in a quarter of a century against the Europeans. I think they're a far superior team, and I just think despite the lack of course knowledge and despite the strategic nature of the course, I think the United States are just too talented for this European team, and I think they're going to win in a dominant manner. I would say it could be. I think they're going to go big or go home, and I think they're going to go big.
19.5, 8.5.
No, I wouldn't. I'd be of the view maybe like the 2 years ago, 17-11.
Right. Okay. 17-11. You've heard it here first. John Duggan's prediction. A couple of quick comments before we let you go. Loving John Duggan's enthusiasm, says Oisin Langan, who's been in touch. I spent the week at that Ryder Cup. He's talking about 06, and all I remember is rain and being pissed off. Press tent had Greg Carvery too. Hal Sutton, the USA captain, being the captain ever of the I can't see the rest of that comment ever of the USA helped Europe big time. Something about Hal Sutton helping Europe big time. I've actually got it up there on screen.
the worst captain ever of the USA helped Europe big time, says Oisin Langan, which is probably true enough.
The captaincy matters. The captaincy matters because it matters a lot in terms of how you're handling players that are not in, because four people will be benched and some players might not see much game time. And also what you're doing on the singles. Because often you can find teams 8-8 or 9-7 and it's close going into the singles. How do you strategically plan? It'll be 11:05 Sunday morning, earlier than possibly we think. Oh, it's 1 o'clock, the Ryder Cup. The Ryder Cup could be well and truly been on the way to being over by then. That so set your clocks for 11:05 on Sunday. But of course, it's 7:10 tomorrow is the first tee shot at Le Golf National.
Absolutely. A couple of other comments. Paul McGee's been in touch on YouTube to say, just not enough support for different sports in this country. Love these two lads, he says about the O'Donovan brothers. Well done and keep it up. Up Skibbereen. Le Bamier, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, sorry for slaughtering your name, which I presume I've just done, on YouTube says, was at the Saturday of the Ryder Cup at the K Club. Brilliant day. Weather was awful early on, with the exception of the Darren Clark narrative. 2006 was not dramatic. USA team were dreadful. Veronica McGreevy then on YouTube says, match by match, session by session, Europe by a narrow margin. You're in the minority this morning, Veronica, it seems, but kind of hope you're right. I've got a suspicion that Europe might surprise a few people this weekend. James Farrell on YouTube says, the United board should sack Pogba and sack Mourinho right now. Realistically, we're not going to win the league or Champions League this season, so Jose should be sacked before next summer. Just do it now, he says. John, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
I really enjoyed my golfing journey.
I enjoyed it too, and it was a journey. It's the only appropriate term to describe what this morning was. It was a journey down the French language. It was a journey down your memorabilia, and which you can check out in our Instagram story as well, at Off the Ball, if you want to see a little bit more from John's unpacking of his 2006 Ryder Cup bag. Coming up today and tomorrow on Off the Ball, it's Alan Quinlan in studio tomorrow morning on OTB AM. Limerick stars Aaron Gillan and Kyle Hayes, and much more too. Today then, to go backwards, the Keith Andrews Show is live at 12:30, and at 7 o'clock tonight, Off the Ball is back here in the radio. It's Thursday night, which means Thursday Night Football with John Giles, and of course, plenty more from the Ryder Cup. Jordy Murphy's been speaking to Will O'Callaghan about the motivations behind his move to Ulster. We'll play you that in just a moment. After that, then, we'll play you out at our interview with Ariel Helwani ahead of McGregor's fight against Khabib on Saturday week. We'll chat to you later. Bye-bye for now.
This is purely a decision for myself. I'd come to a crossroads in my career, and I realised that I needed to move, and I weighed up my options, and Ulster felt like the best fit. And obviously, I'd looked at teams abroad as well, but it was the driving factor was that I wanted to represent Ireland, and with a big World Cup around the corner, I thought that this was the best move for me. So, I talked to Joe once or twice, but he wasn't leaning me one way or the other. He just said to keep him in the loop here and there, and I did so. But it was purely a decision made by myself and my family.
Aside from wanting to stay within the Irish system, and as important as that was, what was the attraction for you about going to Ulster?
I just think they've got a seriously rich history. Any time I've gone up to play them, it's an incredibly tough game, not just because of the teams they put out, but also the kind of fan base they have behind them. So I thought myself personally, it'd be nice to actually go out there and have those fans cheering for you then instead of screaming at you. So that was a big driving factor. Obviously, I would have known a couple of the boys from being involved with Ireland, like obviously Bestie, Hendy, Jacob, a couple of those boys, and then a couple of lads I would have played underage rugby with. Good friend of mine, Marty Moore, had signed for them a couple of weeks beforehand. John Cooney as well. I had a good chat with him over the phone, just seeing how he found it up there. Like, obviously, he'd been at Leinster, Connacht and Ulster, and just what he thought of the place.
All right, it is time to turn back to the UFC. It is Conor McGregor against Khabib Nurmagomedov on Saturday week in Vegas. And I'm delighted to welcome Ariel Helwani of ESPN now back to the show. Ariel, what's the crack?
You know, Owen, I must say, things are going so well that I was going to say the crack is 90. It's actually 91 over here. How about that?
Well, that's great to hear. I dare say the crack is 91 because there's a pretty big fight around the corner, and I'd say the hype is bubbling along nicely.
Yes, it's finally, it feels like there's a light at the end of this tunnel, that we're going to see Conor back. We're around 10 days away now. There hasn't been, you know, a lot of media, a lot of interviews, but they sort of whet our appetite last Thursday in New York City with the press conference, which gave us a lot to digest, a lot to chew on. So I'm ready. I like the fact that from the moment it was announced, up until the fight. It's essentially like a 2-month build. Of course, we've been waiting almost 2 years for Conor to return to MMA, but it feels like it all happened relatively quickly from the moment they announced it, and I like that. It didn't drag on.
No, that press conference has certainly been one of the most dissected, shall I say, press conferences in any sport I can remember over the past couple of years. Like Dana White obviously calling it one of the darkest things he's ever seen. I think a lot of people agreed with that sentiment from Dana White, that it wasn't so much what was said, it was the tone of what was said, it was the body language of McGregor, and that there was this deeper underlying thing here, that there is a real kind of dislike between these two fighters, that this isn't all for show, this isn't all to sell the fight.
Yeah, honestly, I don't really know what Dana White was talking about as far as it being the darkest. You know, this is vintage Conor McGregor. This is why he is beloved. He doesn't just show up to press conferences unprepared and sits back and says, okay, the media is going to ask me questions now and I'm just going to respond. He comes prepared. Not only does he research his opponents as far as their fighting styles are concerned and their height and their reach, things of that nature, he researches their background, and not only does he research his opponent's background, he researches his opponent's team's background as well. So I never thought that at any point it got uncomfortable. Obviously, there was, there weren't any fans there, so it never felt like it was a hostile environment. I'm not sure why fans in Ireland felt that it was, you know, ugly or uncomfortable or whatever you were alluding to. I expected this from Conor, and I expected what we saw from Khabib. So it. Unflappable, not really fazed by it all. They kind of delivered what I think most people wanted to see, and I thought it was, you know, like it was. No, you look back at Conor before the Eddie Alvarez fight. You know, he was loud, he was braggadocious, he was colorful. He was the same thing. I mean, this is no different. Sometimes he turns it up a little here and there, but this is what we've come to expect from Conor.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's quite a measure of taking it, because I think some people are even suggesting that the character of Conor McGregor had changed. They had noticed a shift in how he was performing, that maybe the previous Conor McGregor was, I don't know, he relied less on, I don't know, dark things perhaps to actually put across his charisma, whereas he was maybe less charming last Thursday night, seems to have been a school of thought. I'm not sure if I'd agree with that myself. It depends what you kind of consider charming as well, I'd suppose, and it's all subjective, but I don't know. It seems that maybe you're right, that there isn't as much, we don't need to read into this as much as some people have been doing.
Look, I think the Irish people sometimes, and I don't obviously live in Ireland, I've only been there once, but I have friends who live there, and I work with Peter Carroll, or I used to work with him, and he tells me a lot about what goes on over there, and I think that sometimes the Irish people are too critical of Conor, and they want him to be a certain way. He is who he is, and I know that there's a certain sort of, you know, standard and you need to be a role model. But let's not forget, at the end of the day, all's fair in love and fight promotion. And Conor is going to adapt to whoever he is fighting. So if it, in his mind, requires to go certain places, he's going to go certain places. And I don't think for the most part, Khabib was, like I said, fazed by it. But let's not forget, last year when he was fighting Floyd Mayweather, you know, the press conference in Brooklyn, everyone's like, he crossed the line. He was walking around with the Golden State Warriors CJ Watson jersey that went over most people's head, but that was in reference to Floyd Mayweather's domestic violence allegations. So, or I should say accusations. Conor is not afraid to go to places that other people are afraid to go. And we saw that very, very early on in this whole process when he started talking about on social media, Khabib's father and Chechnya and Dagestan. He's just not afraid. You know, that's part of why people love him. He is going to say things about his opponents that people wouldn't dream even thinking. And we're seeing that now with this fight. And we saw it on display at that press conference.
Yeah, like the one thing that we can quite confidently say that's changed is Conor McGregor and his relationship with the UFC. And obviously, everybody knows about proper whiskey now as a result of what happened in New York last Thursday night. This is a really unique development in world sport and in the history of sport. It's not just in the fight game. This is something that we haven't seen too often. And this is, I don't want to say a concession, but this is certainly quite the allowance from Dana White for proper whiskey to come on as a partner of this big fight.
Well, you know, Dana understands who the big dog is here. And, you know, you just see their demeanor. I mean, to me, that wasn't really the biggest sort of takeaway of that evolving relationship. I don't know if you saw when they squared off and there's a camera angle from Dana's point of view of them facing off and they're sort of talking to each other. and Connor's whispering to him, you're dead. And then all of a sudden, once they're turning towards the crowd, Dana, you know, looks off to the side and says to someone, get Connor's belt, the same two belts that they stripped him of. Mm. And he's like, don't worry, they're coming. I mean, that just says it all. That tells you who, you know, who's the real big dog here. That tells you who's running the show. Connor has had a lot of power for a lot of time. And I don't think that, you know, the whiskey sponsorship is an indication of, you know, some sort of evolving relationship. People were saying, oh, how could they let him box? And that was another indication. Of course, the UFC made a lot of money off of that as well. And you know, how could they let him fight for the lightweight title after never defending the featherweight title? Another indication of his power. How could they let him fight Nate Diaz at 170 after he just lost that fight? Another indication of his power. So this has been, you know, escalating. And you know what? The UFC is right for making concessions for Conor McGregor. He deserves it. He makes them more money than anyone.
Yeah. Well, what do you think the end game is in the mind of the commercial thinking Conor McGregor here in terms of this partnership? Where does he want to end up in terms of his partnership with the UFC?
I think he wants to get paid. I think he wants to have fights that make a lot of sense for him. You know, a lot was made of this new 6-fight contract that he signed. He had 4 fights left on his other deal. So really, the real story is the extra two. But as you may know, contracts in mixed martial arts and in the UFC in particular are not like, you know, I'll equate them to something I know about the NBA or Major League Baseball. You know, at any point, the UFC can cut Conor, especially after a loss, or if he, you know, acts a fool, but they're not going to do that. He's the biggest star in the history of the sport. So what is this? He'll renegotiate after this fight. He'll renegotiate after the next fight. It doesn't really mean anything. So I think that was more PR just to say, like, oh, we got him. He's going to be with us for long term. But Conor, in my opinion, maybe outside of Floyd, you know, who's kind of in, who's kind of out, is the most powerful man in combat sports because he's able to, you know, get these concessions, because he's able to march to the beat of his own drum, because he's able to, you know, be out for a while and still be, you know, considered a champion. And that's a credit to him. No one, you know, a lot of people like to say that, oh, the UFC, you know, they bend it backwards for Conor McGregor and they made Conor McGregor. I don't subscribe to that. I think Conor McGregor made Conor McGregor, and then the UFC, you know, a light went off and they're like, wow, we need to attach ourselves to this guy. But he deserves, in my opinion, the boatload of the credit for everything that is happening to him.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and I guess, like I said earlier on, that maybe concession isn't the right word, because ultimately the UFC are looking at this and they're like, well, if that makes Conor McGregor happy and he's happy to be in bed with us in the UFC, then, you know, we're happy to have this guy with us and we're happy to go on this journey together at this point. It makes commercial sense from Dana White's perspective as well, no?
Absolutely. I mean, okay, so we're going to do a deal to have this whiskey brand on the mat. Okay, great. That or no Conor. I mean, like...
Yeah.
The amount of money that he generates for them, the amount of interest, the amount of buzz, hype, headlines. I mean, there's no one right now that even comes close to him that's on, you know, his level. The only person at the time 2 years ago, you know, when we were last seen actively fighting, you know, he fought at UFC 205. Ronda returned at UFC 207, and she hasn't returned since. She was the only person who was on his level, and I would argue at that point Conor had surpassed her after what he did at Madison Square Garden. So that's just the nature of life. You know, the biggest stars are going to get certain things that other people aren't, the most popular people, et cetera. And, you know, witness what happened in April. If that was just a mid-tier fighter, of course they wouldn't still be on the roster. But I don't think I'm breaking news when I say that people who are at his level in any walk of life, whether it's business, your office, whatever, there are certain people who are going to be treated a different way because of what they, you know, what they bring to the table. And in our sport, Conor's the creme de la creme.
Ariel, is this going to be the toughest fight of Conor McGregor's mixed martial arts career?
Stylistically, yes. There's obviously a lot at play here because of A, Khabib's grappling, his wrestling, his cardio. He's able to go 25 minutes. He doesn't appear to get tired. He has incredible takedowns, incredible wrestling. He's never lost a round. He's never lost a fight. On paper, everything says that this should be the toughest fight of Conor McGregor's career. Plus, you add to that, you know, Conor hasn't fought in almost 2 years. A lot's been going on in his life. How seriously has he been training? There's a lot of question marks there, right? Mm. But conversely, this is the biggest fight of Khabib's career as well. He's never fought a striker like Conor McGregor. He's never fought a talent like Conor McGregor as well. So for both men, what I like about this so much is that it's both of their biggest fights ever, and it's both of their toughest fights ever. And so you can't really like tip the scales in one person's favor, because they're both, you know, it's the classic grappler versus striker matchup. And, you know, every fight starts standing. At some point, it goes to the ground. Who's going to win out? It's a fascinating chess game.
Yeah, like you speak to a lot of people who've been in training camps with both of these guys. Is there any sense at all that Conor McGregor's ground game has got any better over the years since, you know, this hiatus from the UFC?
They continue to say that, you know, I mean, even people that he trains with, like Dylan Danis, have told me that they think that he could out-grapple Khabib. And of course, they're going to back their guy. They're going to be confident about their guy. You know, that's not exactly breaking news per se, but you know, you putting that out there, that's a pretty bold statement. There's no doubt about it. And look, I don't think that Conor is taking this lightly at all. He knows what's at stake here. He knows there's a lot of people who don't think that he can hang with Khabib, and he also knows what's at stake. He can be the guy to give him his first loss, 26-1, and the one is Conor. I mean, that's just another feather in his cap. So I don't foresee that he's taking him lightly, and it's such a hard. I mean, the betting out there is super tight. It's such a hard fight to predict, but I love the fact that you know exactly what both men want to do, right? We know that Conor would like to keep this standing. We know that ideally Khabib wants to keep it on the ground. Who's going to win out?
Yeah, who do you think is going to win?
I knew you were going to ask me that the moment I started talking about predicting. But I shall abstain, my friend. You know why? Because in this game, a lot of people get sensitive. They get a little bit riled up when you make a prediction. They say, oh, now you picked against me. So I've learned over the years that the juice isn't necessarily worth the squeeze on that one. So, I mean, who am I to predict the fight? You're not going to get me to break my rule today, so I'm sorry about that. I'll just leave it at that.
No problem at all. I think you managed to illuminate enough for us and we can make our own decision. Ariel, great to chat up. How are the new digs over at ESPN treating you?
Yeah, not bad. I appreciate it. It's a lifelong dream to work there. Ever since I was a kid, before I even started dreaming of actually doing this for a living, I always thought, wow, what would it be like to work for ESPN, though, the worldwide leader in sports? So it's very cool, and it's great that, you know, I just started 3.5 months ago, and now here we are before arguably the biggest fight in UFC history. And then in January, they're going to be the home of the UFC here in the United States. So perhaps the stars are aligning for me on this one, and I'm very excited to be a part of it.
Well, the show is going great. Congratulations on everything, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Always a pleasure.
OTB AM.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.